Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of For Whom the Bell Tolls. I'm your host, Eric Bell, and we have an exciting episode coming up. First, I should say that KR, or Christopher Banhammer Solves, as he's known on Facebook, who I intend on being my special guest host, it is his birthday today, and his family had already made plans to celebrate it, so he had to go ahead and cancel tonight's appearance. But either way, tonight we should have it, I guess. So I'm sorry for anyone that was listening, looking forward to hearing him. But I can tell you this: we have Christopher Cantwell, who I can promise you is at least as big enough big an asshole as he is, at least. And then we have Josie Wales, and for my next week, and I'll give you a preview for next week's episode. I have a few of my friends that I've known from my hometown of Camden County, Georgia. They have quite a few friends that are my friends are actually they're a lot more libertarian than I left them, and they have a few friends and they're like, hey, you need to go put him on. And they're active in the Libertarian Party, and so I'm going to make my main theme. The theme of the episode is, well, if you're going to call it the Libertarian Party, then it better be libertarian. And I'll be discussing whether or not the Libertarian Party is a relevant tool or a vehicle to get us to a free society. So that should be fun. And I guess I'll be using quite a few things. I guess I'll be hammering and taking a few things that I've got from my interview of Adam Kokesh and applying that and see if we could, and just what exactly a Libertarian Party would look like. So that should be rather fun. And tonight should be really fun for Christopher Cantwell. I can say is one of those people that, you know, you either love him or hate him. There's rarely any middle ground, and he's an activist, which we could use more of those, and there's some of those otherwise. But we have plenty of economists. We have plenty of philosophers within libertarianism. But we have very few entertainers, and so that is why I think one of the reasons why his service is very much welcomed, in my opinion. And when he brings up certain topics, it's something that should be discussed, whether you agree with it or not. But anyway, he should be calling in the next 5 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and go to a quick commercial. And by the time commercial break, and by the time that he calls in, by the time I get back, he should be just calling in. All right. I'll see you later. Just 1 minute. Just talk to you after the commercial.
Did you know most Americans know nothing or very little about the legal system? I am the Rose Colombo, longtime legal activist, legal coach, legal advocate, and the author of Fight Back Legal Abuse, Irwin Award winner, and also my latest political satire, Obamacare Dinosaurs, Rednecks, and Radicals. A political satire exposing the evil agendas of Obamacare and redistribution of wealth that leaves you with a thought-provoking ending. Will mankind survive, or will the U.S. natural-born citizen become extinct? It's available at Amazon.com. You can also visit my website at www.fightbacklegalabuse.com for more information. So order your copy today and empower yourself with knowledge. before injustices come knocking on your back door unexpectedly.
Hi, I have a question for you. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Do you want a company that provides good quality ingredients and does not use artificial sweeteners? Look no further. Genesis Pure has a complete lineup of health and wellness, sports performance, and superfruit juices like noni and mangosteen that are pure, wild harvested with no binders and fillers. The philosophy is simple. Cleanse the body of toxins, balance the body's pH and hormones, and build the body nutritionally. Every race has a starting line, and yours is Cleanse, Balance, Build. Sign up for at least a 25% discount and include auto ship of at least one product to start building up 20% back in points for free products. It's a win-win. Help fund our operation while you fund your body nutritionally. Start your journey at genesispure.com/freedomizerhealth. Again, that is genesispure.com/freedomizerhealth.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
All right, welcome back to For Whom the Bell Tolls. Christopher Cantwell should be calling any minute, and I just got a message via Facebook from Josie Wells and said she'll be calling in about 6:30, which is about a little bit earlier than I planned, but that should be all good. That's not too big of a problem. And, yeah, calling any second. I'm just going to go reply to Josie real quick. And hopefully should be here just any second now. Oh, there he is right there. Hello, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, man. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's definitely a pleasure. Yes, so anyway, I don't know exactly how to get all the stuff that you've been, that you're involved in, but of course you're mainly known for, of course, you're being a fill-in host for Adam vs. the Man during his kidnapping, and also you're the founder of ChristopherCantwell.com, you're an atheist, asshole, and anarchist, or that is, and you've never been one to be shy of controversy. I found one of your, I stumbled across an old article of you during your congressional run where, of course, you made this statement that, of course, our right to bear arms extended to nukes.
That's funny that you brought that up. Yeah, I mean, really right from my entry into the libertarian movement, I've really been, you know, steeped in a lot of controversy. I mean, when I first got started with the Libertarian Party back in 2009. I mean, I was on trial for a DWI. I mean, I was a congressional candidate who wanted to legalize drunk driving, and then went on to discuss private ownership of nuclear weapons not too long afterwards. So you can imagine that I've been ruffling feathers for, you know, quite some time.
Yes, and as I mentioned earlier, it's I like your work, especially as. We say, libertarianism, of course, it It does have a shortage of activists, which you're also one, but of course it doesn't have a shortage of economists or philosophers, but it doesn't, it does have quite a difference, a shortage of, you know, entertainers such as yourself as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's look, I enjoy talking about philosophy and economics and stuff like that. And, I think that these are really interesting topics that a lot of people who are already libertarians will be very interested in. Unfortunately, the majority of the society that we're trying to get on board with our ideas does not give a damn about these things. And you have to entertain them. You have to show them a good time. And then when they realize, hey, you know, this is a group of people that we can have fun with, then maybe, you know, then maybe they'll stick around for an economics lesson after that. But if you just, you know, approach a stranger on the street and be like, let me tell you how the economy works, they're going to blow you off. They're not going to be interested in what you have to say. So I find that, a laugh is a better in than a lecture.
Right. Right. Yes. I wanted to get into one of not just my favorite articles that you wrote, but just in general, because it's so, to me, I found it so just paradigm altering. It's about a libertarian infighting is a good thing. And it's so important because just from my short, knowledge of the history of the libertarian movement there, I cannot point to one particular time where it has ever been united. And, we've wasted a lot of time just, sitting around moping about, why can't we just get along? And, so I like the way you're spin on it, which is very contrary to popular, I like that you found a way to, work it to our benefit.
Yeah, I've since the article that you're speaking of, I've talked about the subject quite a bit and I've elaborated on it. And I think that there's really so many benefits to it. And the thing that I think is most important to realize about it is the people who are talking about the infighting are actually doing infighting. The people who are complaining about the infighting are actually doing some infighting of their own. They're complaining about it. They're saying, hey, we should ostracize these people who are infighting in a lot of cases, right? So they're actually the ones being the most divisive in the movement when they're trying to play this little unity card. And it's a totally false thing that they're trying to do. They're trying to bridge the gap between left and right, which I think is just such a horrible, terrible idea. And what they are always trying to do when they're complaining about infighting and saying that, we should not have this and the people who participate in it should not be, part of this group. What they're usually doing is they're trying to get people to go along with whatever notion of libertarian movement they have. They're not really trying to unify anything. They're just creating more division. Whereas the people who are willing to engage each other, well, they're actually having a meaningful discussion. They're actually providing a source of entertainment for other people and really frequently hashing out very important ideas. And, at the end of the day, in a lot of these cases, one of them loses and one of them wins, but that's not a bad thing. We believe in competition as libertarians, last I checked. Yes. So I think that I can't stress enough the value of a certain amount of infighting. I think that there are bad things that happen in infighting. I think baseless allegations of racism, I think baseless allegations of sexism are really negative things that don't do anything at all to advance the movement. But when people make those allegations and then we attack them for making baseless allegations and we point out the harmful nature of making such baseless allegations, I think that then we help the movement and we advance the movement when we respond to those negative behaviors. So negative infighting is not a negative thing at all. It's perfectly normal. It's as old as politics. And I think that people should, stop worrying about it so much.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the, competition aspect of it. A good example of that was I had on Doug Craig, who's the state chair of the Georgia Libertarian Party, and he brought up, of course, that Michael Badnarik, who I understand is one of your great influences, he said, of course, that he did not believe that he would be any way as radical if Aaron Russo was not in the race. And of course, in watching From Freedom to Fascism, I can definitely see that angle. And Yeah, and conventional wisdom would say how much it would have been, it was just a horrible thing that, you know, it would have been, that would have been so much better if there was no actual primary, if, you know, they just had a, basically a coronation of the Libertarian nominee and just spent and just saved all their money and their resources to go ahead and go against George Bush and whoever, and John Kerry. But, you know, this had such a greater impact because of his message has such a greater impact than what lasted much longer than the 2004 election.
Certainly. I mean, the I can't say that I was terribly familiar with the 2004 Libertarian primary, but I think that to eliminate, you know, primary processes and political parties would be like the worst thing that you can do. I mean, there's buzz in the Republican Party that they're just going to forbid infighting during the primary. And I'm like, what do you think a primary is? The whole point of a primary is to infight and, you know, knock the other guy out of the box and to sort of hash out these issues before the other party comes and starts attacking you. So I think that especially in the case of, you know, Bednarik, anybody out there who thinks that I'm doing good work can directly credit that to Michael Bednarik. So I think the last thing that I would have liked to have seen would have been Michael Bednarik not being as radical. I think that that would have been a detrimental thing. It wouldn't have grabbed my attention. I think that, you know, he really played a very important role in bringing me to these ideas. And I, had he not presented them the way he did, I can't say that I would have found them. So it's important to have, look, I appreciate these people who try to, you know, work with other people and be more welcoming and not as off-putting. I appreciate them because they play an important role too. But, you know, some people, the only way that they're going to respond to these things is to really get in their faces. And that was the case with me. And I'm sure it's the case with countless of others, not the least of which is the hundreds of thousands of people who are visiting my website. I mean, people always told me that I needed to tone it down. And what I did was just turned it up. You know, I turned it up to 11. And what happened was I created one of the most popular libertarian websites on the planet Earth as a result. So anybody who's telling you that, you know, these things don't work, that infighting's a bad thing, that you can't, you know, grow a radical movement this way, they're just plain flat out wrong. The data proves it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and I had Adam Kokesh on last week, and of course, and we talked about his presidential run in 2020. And just getting on, I had made the pitch that I think that he's not interested. If he's going to run, that he should maybe consider running for a Libertarian nomination, just because I know as much as we hate it, and that of course that we try to get away from it, that statists do think that we should. The main thing they do think about libertarianism is the Libertarian Party. And I think it would speak many volumes if he just very implications of that. If he was were to actually get the nomination, would be tremendous. But at the other time, I think going back to your point, it would not about infighting. It would not be a bad thing if we have multiple voices in the 2020 campaign arguing about what libertarian is and what it isn't.
I don't think that that would be a bad thing at all, because, I mean, there are so many people trying to say that libertarianism is so many different things, you know, anything from this just loosely knit idea of freedom all the way to, you know, my hardline position of the non-aggression principle. So I think that it's necessary for people to, you know, to have that argument. And I would like to see that in the Libertarian Party primary. I can't say that I've ever watched a Libertarian Party presidential primary. I'm not sure exactly how those things look, unfortunately. But I would say that, you know, there's ups and downs to that for the candidate, right? So if Adam Kokesh were to seek the Libertarian Party nomination in 2020 and he lost the primary, he would largely be expected to step down from the race. In many states, you cannot lose a primary and then go on to get ballot access as an independent candidate after losing the primary.
That's what I'm saying. If he wasn't to go seek for it, I'm saying it wouldn't be such a bad thing as you do if someone else was to get the nomination. I mean, you would do have two self-proclaimed libertarianism just have different voices, and you'd have more of a more chance of a debate of what libertarian is.
Yeah, there's ups and downs to it. You know, on the other side of that coin is, you know, look, by running with the Libertarian Party, if you win the primary, well, now, you know, it's a source of revenue. You get money for your campaign. I mean, Michael Badnarik, I think, raised $1 million in 2004. I think Gary Johnson raised more than that. You know, through the Libertarian Party, you can raise more money. You can more effectively spread a message. Whereas, you know, as an independent candidate, you know, it's a lot more difficult because you don't have the organization, you don't have the structure to get on the ballot in different places. You need petitioners and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, there are ups and downs to it. Obviously, it's a value judgment that everybody has to make. But, you know, the more libertarian voices out there, the better at the end of the day, right?
Right. Okay. Okay, so as I mentioned, I was going to wait. So, of course, I don't know if I should really get into libertarian Buddhism, or I should really wait until – I was going to wait until Josie Wales comes in to get into defensive force, but she messaged me and said she'd be a lot earlier. So.
Well, whatever you'd like to do. It's your program, obviously. I think that defensive force is part of libertarian brutalism, frankly. It's why brutalism label really appealed to me. I think that, you know, the brutalism versus humanitarians thing has really been very focused on sort of like a left libertarian-leaning, you know, focus. But don't forget that, you know, traditionally pacifism is a left-wing idea too, right? Now, it doesn't really pan out that way because, you know, in left-wing circles, they give the power to use violence to governments, but it is leftists who want to disarm us. It is leftists who want to, you know, to call themselves pacifists, even if they're willing to let the government create great violence on their behalf. So I would say that they're talking about, you know, cooperation and everything else, which is, you know, just communism. So I think that when people are talking about, you know, expelling defensive force from libertarianism, they're absolutely, you know, taking a left-wing position. And I've tried to, you know, associate the libertarian brutalism being the bare naked non-aggression principle, that you're not adding to it, you're not taking away from it. This is what this means, and stop trying to stray from it. Because people have tried to say that, okay, libertarianism, now we're going to have thick libertarianism, and, you know, this is going to oppose all social structures that, you know, we perceive are, you know, involved in oppression, whether it's, you know, gender identity or race or you know, sexism, any number of different things, whichever the liberals are concerned with that day is what the libertarian left wants to concern themselves with. And on the, you know, it's just as much a left libertarian issue to call change non-aggression to non-violence. Those are two extraordinarily different terms. And when people start saying non-violence, I really feel compelled to correct them, because libertarianism is not opposed to force. It is opposed to initiatory violence and fraud. And if people are using initiatory violence and fraud, the way it's dealt with is force. So when you're saying that we can't discuss force, you're saying that we can't discuss libertarianism. You're distorting the debate and really ruining it. And brutalism really is all about bringing it back to that core of non-aggression and respect for property rights, where if you violate my property rights, I can use force to stop you.
Absolutely. You know, I was I was still very naive and said this, but I never actually expected such a left infiltration. If anything, I always expected, if anything, if there would be any distortion from libertarianism or any type of co-opting, it would be from the right, if nothing else. I mean, just going back from Reagan, or just – and then, of course, you go to the Tea Parties, just for appealing to them, and the Glenn Beck types and – whatever. Do you see that as? Do you see that? Do you see ever? Do you fear of that being as prevalent as from the left, or has that calmed down?
I see it being every bit as prevalent, especially when we're starting to deal with electoral politics. Right. Once we start talking about voting for people, we're absolutely encouraged to vote for right wing Republicans. We're, you know, Ron Paul, you know, Julie Borowski, you know, anybody who's, I'm sorry, not even Ron Paul, but Rand Paul, is, you know, these things are extraordinarily serious influences from the right and foreign policy decisions. We saw Students for Liberty advocating for some limited military intervention in the Ukraine. this is very common that we have right-wing influences, and it's a serious problem. You can read on, LouRockwell.com, they're frequently talking about the Koch-topus, that the Koch brothers are, you know, involved with Reason Magazine and the Cato Institute, and any number of different outlets, Students for Liberty again. These things are very perverse influences from the American political right who are trying to distort and really destroy libertarianism. And I think it's worth combating at every front because it's dangerous. They're distorting what it means, and they can do to libertarianism what they did to liberalism. You know, it wasn't so long ago historically that, you know, now some people refer to libertarianism as classical liberalism, and I do draw a distinction between those two things. But you know, what was classical liberalism was very similar to libertarianism, but because they were so concerned with these social constructs and because they used state power, what they became is modern liberals who are anything but caring about freedom. And we don't want that to happen to libertarianism.
Okay. All right. I just got a message from Josie Wales telling me to tell her to let her know when you finished your point. So I'll go ahead and tell her to call in.
Very good. So, while we wait for Josie to come in, I'm a huge fan of her YouTube videos. I'm so glad to be on with her. She's a wonderful, talented, and young lady who's very easy on the eye. And she gave a great talk a couple of weeks ago, if it was even that long ago, at Liberty Fest NYC, talking about defensive force. I'm glad to be on with her.
Okay. Maybe just any second now. All right, come on, Josie. While we're waiting, do you have anything you'd like to plug? Any events coming up or?
I do not have any public appearances scheduled right now. That's probably going to change in the near future. I have a couple of work and financial and personal matters that I'm straightening out, and then hopefully get back on the road. I was just in New Jersey not too long ago. We did a Liberty Circus where I, got up, made a presentation, told some jokes, and there was another gentleman who was more a constitutional-leaning gentleman who did some magic tricks and talked about law and taxes and society and whatnot. It was very interesting. That's up on my website, my YouTube channel. You can search for that NJ Liberty Circus. But as of right now, I don't have anything coming up. Just you can obviously follow me on Twitter. It's Vote for Cantwell on Twitter, and the website is ChristopherCantwell.com. And there you'll find my YouTube channel and my writings and all the crazy, wonderful, stupid things that I'm up to at any given day of the week, because I'm producing content just about every single day, and it's getting more and more popular. So they should probably subscribe to the email list so that they get it all in their inbox for the next time I get banned from Facebook.
Oh, yes, I definitely done that. Well, yeah, I'm going to welcome Josie to the show. I'll go show. Hey, Josie, how's it going?
Can you hear me?
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, I can hear you. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Just doing very great. And, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Josie. It's Cantwell.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Hanging in there.
Yes.
Thanks for coming on.
For that, yes, Josie Wales, a.k.a. Josie the Outlaw. And last time I checked, she was now in the leading on the Libertarian Brutalism Facebook as our queen. So,
which is hysterical that a group of libertarians are voting on a queen. But, yeah, I mean, that was definitely an entertaining poll, and I enjoyed reading it. And I actually – I originally voted for Cantwell and Heels, and then I did. I really wanted him to win. And then Emma got bumped to under Bueller, and I was like, oh, fuck, I can't let that happen. So, so I changed my vote to Emma. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting group. I mean, the forum is very interesting. It's a great time, and there's some great, provocative discussions. in a philosophical way, and there are some very provocative discussions in not even close to a philosophical way. But it's all in good fun, and it's a great time.
Yeah, that Facebook group. I mean, it's one of the better things that I, you know, ever managed to find myself involved in as far as Facebook goes. You know, there's lots of larger groups because people go and, like, you know, spam invite all of their friends. But it seems to me like just about everybody that's involved in that group, you know, joined on their own accord, whether it was because people shared content from it when it was still open or because people were tagging it and talking about it. It's very active, much more active at 1,800 members than, say, the anarcho-capitalism group at 2,600. And we're, you know, we're not even 2 months old. So it's a real blast. And it goes to show, I mean, people think that one of the things that's, you know, so commonly criticized is that, you know, if you allow people to, you know, sort of say what they want, you know, have some of this, you know, dirtier humor or to discuss use of force, people are telling us that, you know, this is going to chase people away from libertarianism. And again, I just say the data just plain proves you wrong, that, you know, we create these things and they become some of the most popular things around, specifically because we're letting loose and people are so sick of this really weak and politically correct, bland libertarianism that people are pushing. And once you remove all of those negative influences and let people just say what they want to say, you know, as it turns out, people have a lot of fun and it gets people engaged.
Absolutely. And it's definitely not a watered down version, you know, of libertarianism that's discussed. It's very concentrated, you know, I hate the word purist or pure, but it's, you know, it's definitely a very solid, consistent, version of libertarianism. I mean, and I hate to say version because apparently now there are so many out there. But, you know, there was just recently a post of, you know, should we eject Julie Borowski from the group? I don't know if you saw my response, Chris, but I was like, what in the no? Why? She's the focal point of most of the posts, and she takes it very well and dishes it back out in a pretty entertaining way. And I like the fact that she's there.
Yeah, me too. I would say that, like, look, I clarified in that thread. I said, look, you can't support Rand Paul and call yourself a brutalist, but I'm really happy to have her in there, that she can, you know, be a good sport while people are joking around about her, and she'll have a blast bashing lefties with us. That's one thing that Julie does extraordinarily well. I like her chasing around the
Absolutely.
Check your privilege crowd. So, you know, she's a welcome addition to the party there.
Absolutely, yeah. It is a great group. And at first, when I first heard of, you know, and when I first heard of libertarian brutalism, I always thought of it as, you know, the architecture, because that's what I learned in
yes.
my advanced indoctrination camp in college. So I was like, what in the heck? Then to me, it just sounded like brutalist. And I thought, is that just another form of brutalist? And then I realized that, you know, it's basically just straightforward, you know, no holds barred, balls to the wall, like honest liberty and freedom, basically.
Well, I don't know if you watched, you know, how that unfolded. I mean, it started off as a reference to the architecture, that basically, you know, brutalism, the architecture, and that's probably a good thing to explain to the audience here, is that, you know, brutalist architecture is a style of architecture that really values form over function over aesthetics, right? That it exposes the structure of the building, very plain concrete building that is, you know, built for the purpose of housing people and things. And it doesn't hide that with all the fancy aesthetics that most modern architecture does. And this was brought up, the comparison was made by Jeffrey Tucker, who, if anybody's not familiar, is a pretty high profile libertarian. He's been involved with the
mm-hmm.
with the Institute. He's a publisher at Laissez-Faire Books. And is now running like a silly pay-to-blog platform that's going to be a miserable failure of a business. But he wrote this article called Against Libertarian Brutalism, where he basically said that, you know, this non-aggression principle, bare-bones libertarianism, is like a bad thing, that it's, you know, it's racist and sexist and, you know, all sorts of horrible things. And I had come back, as well as a number of others, and really condemned what he said about it, and embraced the term brutalism, because I said, yes, this is exactly what it is. It's bare bones libertarianism. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. And it's actually as inclusive as you can get, because all we want to eject from society is initiatory force and everything else is welcome.
Right.
So how much more inclusive could you make a thing where the only rule is don't hit? And somehow people think that by adding more rules to it, they're making it more inclusive, but they could not be more wrong.
No, and I totally agree. And I actually didn't know that that was how it originated. So now I don't feel like an idiot for immediately associating it with the architecture.
I like end up correcting it from time to time because people say, oh, that's brutal, or, you know, talking about it as brutality. And I'm like, well, no. It's brutalism. It's absolutely – the idea is absolutely based around the architecture, but I mean, brutal or brutality, you know, sort of fits into it in a way as well, because I mean, look, the market can be a brutal thing. You know, we're not trying to protect people from failure here. It's it's sink or swim time, ladies and gentlemen, and that's what freedom is. And by the way, you know, if you attack me or my property, you can expect a fairly brutal response under non-aggression principle, bare bones libertarianism. So
right.
When people are trying to, you know, besmirch that, to throw brutalism around as a pejorative, I say, well, I'll embrace that label. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think the only place that the only issue on which, Chris, you and I differ when it comes to defensive force is that I think you and I had discussed this before. I think you and I had discussed about how, I advocate opposite and equal force, when brought to me. And I think you, to a point, will take it one step further and say, okay, well, I'm just going to make sure that you can never do that again, so I'm going to do everything in my power to, for lack of a better word, destroy you as a person so you can't hurt me again.
Okay, that's an interesting take on it. And yes, I wrote an article called Doctrine of Proportionality is Madness, because proportionality of force is it's ridiculous. You cannot win a violent conflict using equal and opposite force. It's that simple. The only way you win a violent conflict is by levying more violence against your opponent than your opponent can levy against you. You have to end the threat in order to, you know, solve the problem. Now, whether that person has to be permanently disabled, whether they have to die or not, is another question. However, you know, as I outlined in that article, you don't necessarily know going into it, you know, how much violence your opponent is capable of bringing to you. I mean, if somebody is, you know, in your home, the goal is to get them out of the house, you know. And if you, look, Josie, you're a female. You're not the largest woman I've ever met. I don't expect you to go and, you know, put your hands on an intruder, right? I think that for you to go and try to, you know, go into hand-to-hand combat with a grown man in your house is a dangerous and crazy thing that I wouldn't expect you to do. For the most part, I wouldn't do that myself, and I'm a 260-pound man, because when I approach that guy, I don't know if he's got a gun. I don't know if he's got a club. I don't know what sort of violent conflict that I'm going to find myself in. So I am a guy who says eliminate the threat, you know, with whatever level of force you perceive in your own mind to be necessary to do so.
I definitely absolutely see your point, and I don't know if it's me being an idealist or hoping for the best, but I guess my approach is to as long as I can and until, because I do change my mind. I mean, we all evolve in our philosophies, and we change as we grow and experience, but as of right now, I still am going to stick by the opposite and equal force, hoping that that will scare the shit out of them. Because a lot of times bullies, once you show that you're not going to lay down and be like, all right, cool, just take it, most of the time they'll back down from my own experience. Now, if someone's coming in my house with the intent of killing me, I have yet to experience that, but then I guess it's a different story, but that I won't know. So I guess that's something I do have to think about, and that is a great point that you bring up. So thank you for that.
I would expound upon that, and I would say that, look, if you find someone in your house, you don't know if they're there to kill you. You know, you have no idea, right? So the only way that you can find out is if you ask them, You know, and when you ask an intruder, if you approach someone who's broken into your house, who's obviously, look, they don't really care about your liberties and rights. They're not a person who's there to help you, clearly, because they're violating your property already. For you to go and, you know, ask, inquire as to this person's intentions, that's very dangerous. And even, I mean, even to do it from afar, frankly, I mean, let's say, you know, you're at the top of the stairs with your rifle and you say, hey, you there, what are you doing here? I mean, now you've given away tactical advantage by revealing your position.
In that situation, I don't mean to interrupt you, but in that, like in that situation, if someone's breaking into my house, if someone is forcefully breaking into my house, I don't care if they're wearing a uniform, if they're a unicorn that looks a little bit evil, if like a bear just, you know, somehow bust through my front door. Number one, I'm firing off a warning shot. That's my absolute first thing. And then if they still advance, this has always been my theory, and this is how I imagine it in my head, and I know it's not reality, but this is how I would imagine it. If they still advance or if they don't run, then I guess, you know what, you're right. It's not opposite and equal force. It's more force because they haven't hit me yet.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's no such thing as opposite and equal force, really, in a violent conflict. So, if you win a conflict, you're necessarily using more force than they're capable of withstanding one way or the other. And to try to, you know, make it equal and opposite just means that you both end up bloody and tired at the end of the day. That's not what that is. And, I mean, look, whether you fire a warning shot or whether you shoot them straight through the head and ask questions later, that's a tactical decision that you make for yourself. All I'm really saying is that, as far as the non-aggression principle is concerned, that the goal is to eliminate the threat using whatever level of force is necessary in the perception of the victim, that the victim is in control of the situation. Because once a person crosses that boundary, once a person decides to be the aggressor, once they make that crossover between, you know, I'm respecting your rights and now I'm going to use harm, now I'm going to harm you, well, once that happens, they have to be removed from control of the situation. They've proven themselves to be incompetent. They've proven themselves to be a harmful influence. And whatever is necessary in the mind of the victim becomes empowered at that point is basically my whole premise. And I understand, that, you know, if you have to think about it or whatever, but the way I preface this is that anything less than that actually empowers aggressors at the expense of victims. And that's got to be the antithesis of all libertarian thought to date, that to say that, you know, the aggressor has some right in the matter to maintain some level of control. I really think, it's something that empowers aggressors at the expense of victims. And we certainly don't want to do that in society.
And I agree with that. Yeah. Although I do think there are steps. I mean, it's situation by situation, so it's tough to describe every situation and how to handle it. But
in each situation, you as the person who's the victim in the situation is in complete control of that. Is my only point here? You know, you make a tactical decision. You make a tactical decision. Look, if you're in your house, if you're in any situation where there's a threat to you, okay, where someone's, you know, crossed that line of I'm an aggressor, well, you obviously have all the options in the world at this point is my whole entire take.
Right. And my
kill anybody. Certainly. That's ridiculous. You know, that would be a violation of the non-aggression principle myself that I'm saying, what are you doing? You have to do, you know, I can't tell people what to do. But,
well,
of course,
Sorry, go ahead.
Eric, you were going to say something. I'm sorry. We've just sort of gone back and forth. We almost forgot that we had a host.
Great. It's fine. I assume when people are listening for mainly you and Josie, and I mean, of course, I like them to listen to me, but you know, that's how it basically is. So.
You keep on building up your audience, man. You keep on having guests on. You keep on chiming in with, you know, thoughtful input, and you will build an audience that way. I mean, I started off with a blog talk radio show, you know, in 2009 or 2010, and, like, you know, not too many people were interested in me at that point. But, yeah, you know, I kept on producing content, and, you know, the data speaks for itself now. You just keep on doing it, and eventually you'll build up interest in it.
Right. All right. Well, yeah, well, in the – of course, back to the defensive force. Me and Kokesh had touched on it slightly a little bit, and he had made just a little bit said that there really isn't much difference between your position, Chris, and, well, his. It's just really a matter of just mainly rhetoric, so to speak, and And of course, and like to say, I mean, and I think, and just your certain amount of edginess and your charm. Of course, it's very hard.
Oh, he's so charming, isn't he?
Of course. And I'm very certain that you said that the use of defensive force in just actually in this killing agents of the state is, I believe, as watch it, you made that very clear in your debate in the Keene Convention, that you agree that it's not always exactly the most practical outcome, solution. Am I?
Well, yeah. I mean, look. I mean, you have every right to smoke cigarettes. I'm not saying I recommend doing it. If there was a bunch of people out there saying that you have no right to smoke cigarettes, I'd be the first one out there to say, hey, that's ridiculous. He can smoke cigarettes if he wants. You know, cigarettes are hazardous to your health. They make it difficult to walk upstairs, and you know, all those sorts of things. And you know, obviously, getting into gunfights with the police officers is a very dangerous thing, that you can get yourself shot, or you can find yourself on the run for murder. Or it's just a scary thing to do. Like, even if nothing happened to you, then obviously you're going to be dealing with whatever effects you're dealing with that mentally after being in that combat situation. So, you know, people obviously have to make that choice for themselves. And most of us are not doing things that are going to be worth the risk. You know, most of us are going to get a traffic ticket or something, and it's just not worth dealing with. However, you know, I think that people have the right to sell drugs, right? So, you know, if you're traveling with, a pound of cocaine in your trunk, and, you get pulled over on the highway when you see a dog, I wouldn't be traveling with a pile of cocaine in my trunk, but if I was, I'd be really trying to shoot that cop before he got into my trunk, because I am not going to spend 20, 30 years in prison for having some powder in my car.
Yes, I would. I can definitely see that. And yeah, lost my train of thought by that.
If that's a reasonable thing for me to do because I have cocaine in my car, then it's just as reasonable a decision if a person decides to make it, you know, on their own accord. If a person decides, I'd rather, you know, shoot this cop than pay this traffic ticket, I say that's a perfectly acceptable, you know, decision for them to make. It might not be worth it, you know, but it's a value judgment that an individual makes for himself. The point of it is that, you know, you have the right to deal with, once a person becomes an aggressor, you have every right to remove them from control of that situation. And anything less, like I said, it empowers aggressors at the expense of victims, and we don't want to have that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and if you want to argue from a libertarian, of course, on libertarian principles, you are absolutely 100% right. I would say, but just as human beings, and of course, would not attach what I'm about to say. I will not attach this to libertarianism. That I definitely say that this is not something that we do not want to ever, you know, get in those situations for, you know, something what we consider very minor, such as that, such as traffic tickets or jaywalking or, you know, shit like that.
Well, but we also want those situations to stop happening, right? So, I mean, this is the thing, and I do think I'm going to be having a discussion with Adam on this, because I've never really had a use of force discussion with Adam before. Very few people are willing to discuss this topic. So Adam and I were, you know, chatting the other day, and there will probably be a YouTube video up sometime within the next month or so of us, you know, having that, you know, use of force discussion, because it's more than one thing, right? We're talking about philosophical, moral concepts. And then we're talking about strategic things, you know, and I do think strategically that I differ with Adam in that I feel that force is necessary, that, you know, that we cannot, that people, if they want to see a stateless society, if they want to live as free and individual human beings, that they are going to have to, somebody, maybe not, you know, everybody, maybe not everybody wants to live in a free society, but some folks who are concerned with these things are going to have to use force, because the state will not depart peacefully. Adam, to my understanding, thinks that freedom is inevitable, that it will happen at some point, even if we just sort of don't do anything, because technology will sort of outpace the state. I don't believe that. I think that's, you know, kind of dangerous. And, you know, I look forward to hashing those issues out with him a little bit more in the future.
Well, yeah, well, I would say his difference between him and, say, Stefan Molyneux is, you know, I would say where he may say that it may be inevitable, but, you know, it's inevitable is really not soon enough in this case. And of course, I would say, he would definitely, enter cases where we could say strategically would say, obviously, if a cop was about to kill you, or, you know, if there's ever martial law like in Boston last year, then obviously, I would say there's really no other option but to do that. Or if you're just going to go confiscate all your guns, and where you would have no other opportunity to shoot them afterwards.
Well, when you have a situation like what you had in Boston, I mean, the martial law comes after the guns are taken, and the guns are taken in a progressive fashion, right? So, I mean, it starts with serial numbers, and then it's fully autos, and then it's registration, and then it's handguns, and then you don't have any guns, and then the tanks start rolling down your street. So, I mean, the thing that I think people get away from, unfortunately, is that they say, well, this encroachment of the state is relatively minor, that this is something that you're really overreacting to, Chris. Just because they, locked some people up in Florida for feeding the homeless doesn't mean that you should run out and start shooting at police. And I say, well, what happens is that there's these incremental things, and we see outrage after outrage after outrage, and the only answer that the state gives us is to vote them out of office if we don't like it. And election after election after election. Things get worse every single time, and people go do their civil disobedience, and things get worse every single time. And if people are not starting to notice a pattern developing here, then I don't really know what to tell them. Something has to be done to stop this from happening. And if the people who are telling you that the only option that you have is to vote them out, and you know that voting them out doesn't work, then the only other option that they're giving you is to stop them by force. And if people don't understand that very plain language that's coming from the people who are harming them, then I don't know what to tell them. But this seems to me fairly obvious.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can understand. You have anything to add, Jesse?
I'm still thinking about the cocaine in the trunk scenario and shooting them before they get to the car. Now, if I can go back to that just for 1 second. I do believe we all definitely all have to choose our battles. And there comes a point where, I mean, clearly there's not a critical mass of people speaking out in a manner that is really spreading the word and really getting other people to understand it. So when it comes to those of us who are doing that and who do have the means, and the following and whatever it is to get the word out there, I feel like those of us have kind of a responsibility to at least choose our battles wisely and live to fight another day. Now, I absolutely understand that if someone is aggressing upon me, whether he's in a uniform or not, again, and threatening my life, then absolutely I will do everything in my power to not only neutralize it, but, fight back forcefully. However, when it comes to, let's use the cocaine in the trunk scenario, and they have a dog, it is what it is. I don't know. I definitely wouldn't immediately just shoot the cop before he gets to me. Because I have an option after that. Say I'm put in prison, or I'm arrested and put on trial for having cocaine. Well, in that situation, I'm running. I'm not sticking around for trial. I'm not doing any of that. I'm disappearing. And that would be – that's my perspective.
That's if you're given the option to do that. I'm sorry. Continue.
It's okay. Wait, I'm sorry. What did you say?
I said that's if you're given the option to do that, by the way, because not everybody who gets caught with a pile of cocaine in their trunk makes bail. Last I checked, I don't know what your income is like, Josie, but I don't think that you're a particularly rich woman that, if somebody sets $100,000 bail on you, like could easily happen if you got caught with a trunk full of cocaine, then I imagine that, especially now that you're out that product, that making bail would be extraordinarily difficult. And then attached to that, sometimes they will put – ankle bracelets on people. And of course, your YouTube channel and your discussion of use of force would make you, especially what you just said right now, would make you a flight risk. The state would be terribly unlikely to release you from its prisons, and you will probably not have the option to run. The moment that you allow yourself to be taken into custody, you have given up all right to defend yourself or to escape. You are at their mercy the moment that you submit. The moment that you take away your ability to defend yourself, you are at the mercy of your aggressor. And if that's a tactical decision that you make, then of course that's just fine. Whatever your personal preferences in the matter are, I understand that. And that's something that everybody has to judge for themselves. However, don't think that you're just going to be able to run away. If you're arrested on a felony, there's a good chance that you're not going to get out of jail ever.
Oh, and I do understand that. However, that would be a tactical move on my part, because and I'm not saying that, you know, all I'm saying is I wouldn't shoot the cop before he gets to my car. That is the bottom line. I wouldn't do it because I don't know for a fact that this dog is going to smell whatever he's going to smell, or whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I don't know that. So
That's like a personal preference that you're making as a tactical decision in the moment, and not necessarily like, you know, a requirement of a libertarian argument, right? Like what you're describing is a personal preference there, and I don't blame you for having it, you know. But of course, once this guy has pulled you over, he's threatened your life. We all understand that, you know, to pull your car over to the side of the road, whether it's to put a dog in your trunk and catch you with cocaine, or whether it's to give you a speeding ticket, he has threatened your life. He's an aggressor. He's someone who would have killed you to get you to stop your car. So whatever you have to do to deal with that situation, you're dealing with a violent, belligerent threat of a man who's ready to take your life. And whatever you want to do after that is obviously up to you, but you have options all the way up to and including deadly force.
Absolutely. And I totally understand that. And I am acknowledging that is my personal preference. I just wanted to, just because I didn't say anything or interject doesn't, I just wanted to put that out there that is my personal preference, that I don't, I mean, if I get pulled over for a speeding ticket or for speeding or for what, a tail light out, I'm not going to shoot the cop before he gets to my car.
It's not worth the effort. I mean, I paid a speeding ticket not too long ago, right? I mean, I paid a parking ticket not too long ago. I don't go out and say, hey, you, and, you know, go and gun them down and find myself on the run for murder, because the value judgment just isn't there. However, you know, what I have found, and it's being fixed, we are repairing this situation, that little by little people are being forced to accept that the libertarian answer to this question is use of force up to and including deadly force. A few months ago, a couple years ago, really, that was not the case. When I first moved to New Hampshire, people absolutely told me that this isn't even we didn't even get into the practical argument. They're telling me that, you know, I'm doing something immoral, that, you know, this is against the non-aggression principle, that this is anti-libertarian. And I've made that argument, and Larkin has made that argument, and you've made that argument. And slowly people are starting to come around and understand, well, now let's change it to a practical discussion, because we're losing this moral philosophical thing from the perspective of trying to change libertarianism into pacifism. The people who have been trying to do that, they lost that argument, and now it's strictly about the practicality of it. And the practicality of it, again, value judgments that each individual has to make.
Absolutely. And that's why when I do speak to people, and I, you know, I'm sure you listened to the speech, I did say that I don't presume to tell anyone where to draw their line if they see someone being beaten to death by a gang of police. But I know from my own history that maybe it's instinct, I don't know what it is, but I would absolutely hand my camera to someone else and jump in and do whatever I could. And I know it's a danger. Absolutely, especially if it's a gang of thugs, heavily armed. However, I can't within my own my own conscience, I guess, just stand by and start and just keep filming. But like I said, I don't presume to tell anyone else where to draw their line, because I have the advantage of not having a family to take care of and not having all these responsibilities, but almost everyone else does. So I can do that and not leave, you know, children without a mother. So it's easy for me to say that, but again, I don't presume, like you said, I don't presume to tell anyone else what they should or should not do in this situation.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is, you know, part of the thing that I've been trying to do is when we do hear about these, you know, shootings where government agents are getting killed, You know, I've been trying to, in some of these articles, you know, stand up for the guy who did the shooting, you know, just to say, look, you know, this guy or this woman or whatever the situation might have been was, you know, acting against a threat to her and everyone else, that this is a justified response. And, you know, if you don't want to do it, again, we all understand personal preferences. Nobody's trying to tell anybody what they must do here. But the thing that, you know, has happened, unfortunately, is that even in the libertarian community, we see a guy like Paul Ciancia go and shoot up a bunch of TSA agents. And everybody says, oh, well, that's so terrible, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, you know, the TSA, they are government agents who are out to harm people. They are receiving stolen money. They are patting people down. They are controlling transportation. They're a threat to all of our safety. If you ever want to leave the country, then these people are going to be the ones who prevent you from doing it. And, you know, to see these people demonized, I think is really negative. And so I've sort of tried to display that, the other side of that argument.
Oh, and I as well do the same. I don't always, you know, rejoice when anyone dies. I don't care who it is, you know, when Adolf Hitler. I don't enjoy the loss of life in any way, shape, or form. I don't care how evil they are. I will never throw a party and rejoice. I will be grateful to myself silently that this person is no longer a threat to society. However, it's for some reason I just can't rejoice in it. But I will absolutely defend the person who neutralized that threat in whatever way, whether it be with deadly force or however else they neutralized it. I don't know. But I totally agree with you.
You know, we should treat the death of government agents the way government agents treat the death of, say, Osama bin Laden, right? That you know, we have, you know, parades, people cheering, all these wonderful things are happening because Osama bin Laden is dead. And I see government agents in a similar light. I think that, you know, hey, so Osama bin Laden's dead. And, you know, sure, it would have been a better thing that Osama bin Laden had just been a swell guy and not killed a bunch of people. And I can totally wish that, you know, he had, you know, chosen a different course for his life. However, if he's not going to do that, then, you know, him being dead is a lot better than him being alive. And I can say the same thing for any police officer, TSA agent, or politician.
And I agree. And I can understand your point. However, I do everything in my power to try not to act like a government agent. I don't, just because they rejoice in the death of, you know, quote-unquote terrorist in their eyes, or the way they put it out to be,
mm-hmm.
just because they act a certain way or they put it out there a certain way, I don't feel the need to do that because I, number one, do not ever want to be known as acting like any kind of federal agent, ever.
But also, you know, we also, as content producers, we have a propagandist role to play here, okay? So, like, look at the propaganda that we see on television. The way the state perpetuates itself is by celebrating these things. That, you know, the soldiers are such brave heroes that they protect our freedom by murdering all these strangers halfway around the world that we never would have met otherwise. You know, and
right,
this is how the state maintains
its... Chris, that's after hundreds of years of indoctrinating people to be patriots and to be nationalists. We don't have that advantage right now.
But don't you think that it actually started off that way? I mean, it would seem to me that this is, you know, I mean, you know, we don't have any record of, you know, the first government. Governments have been around since prior to the advent of written language. However, you know, I think that, you know, sort of like at the beginning of it, Adam Kokesh, you know, uses this example of the guy who could pick up the biggest rock. And so the guy who could pick up the biggest rock, he was the, you know, the leader of the tribe or whatever. And, you know, and what he did was basically, you know, provide these people a certain level of protection and they were grateful for it. So I think that, you know, as time went on, they began, you know, sort of celebrating this guy. And then, you know, after he did some terrible things, they decided they should vote on who the guy who picks up the biggest rock is. And then, you know, you just celebrate whoever happened to get elected. And there's got to be that, you know, shift at some point. I mean, you know, how does that shift happen? Well, it happens through propaganda. It happens through changing public perceptions. If the problem is that we don't have the perception on our side, then our role as propagandists is to change the perception.
Oh, I agree. That's absolutely
true,
agree. However,
I'm a very difficult guy to argue with. I know. I'm sorry.
No, you're not. No, you're not in any way a difficult guy to argue with. I don't think this is arguing at all, but I don't think you're a difficult guy to argue with. Although I think absolutely we need to change the perception first before we start. And then again, I mean, people can do whatever. I don't know how you feel about swearing on your show.
Well, I'm told to keep it to a minimum, but, you know, whatever.
Okay. People can act however the hell they want to act and rejoice in whatever death they want to act or whatever death they want to rejoice in. That affects me zero. However, I personally choose not to do that because I don't think that I'm going to gain any benefit, and I don't think I'm going to open people's minds by screaming and yelling and, you know, shooting off little fireworks and sparklers because someone died, especially someone who the majority of society, you know, puts up on a pedestal, like someone in the army or a police officer or a politician or whoever it may be. That tactically is not going to work for me and for the message that I'm putting out there right now.
But if it doesn't work for you as a personal preference, that's fine. But if you're telling me that that's,
yeah,
you know, not going to turn people on, well, then I would tell you that I've got data that proves that just blatantly false, right? That as a matter of fact, as it turns out, and I'm glad that there are people out there who are presenting a calmer message. Don't get me wrong, because there are people who will only react to that. I understand this. So I'm certainly not saying that everybody should, you know, do what I do. But I would tell you that, you know, the idea that this does not wake people up, this does not turn people on, that this is, you know, not going to further the cause, well, that's just plain false. Because it's, as it turns out, the more hateful and violent the things I say, the more traffic I drive, and the more messages I get of people who say, I have been waiting to hear this for years. People don't get this type of thing anywhere else in the world. I'm the only person who's putting out the type of content that I'm putting out. And I am hateful and vicious, and I say terrible things about people, and I celebrate the death of government agents and anti-gun activists. And as it turns out, there are people who have been waiting to hear this for so long, and they're not necessarily libertarians, right? That they're just kind of pissed off people, right? So if you give these really pissed off people this consistent message of non-aggression, there's so many angry people out there who just have no idea why they're angry, you know, that you can actually reach out to these people and say, hey, you know, this is why you should be pissed off, and here's a sound philosophical grounding for your anger, and this is something that you can articulate and change minds with. And it absolutely, you know, it's doing wonderful, wonderful things, I assure you.
Oh, and I'm not saying that it doesn't work. What I'm saying is for me, I mean, and for the message that I'm putting out there and for the way I do it, you know, for my, you know, I hate to say public persona, but I guess that's the truth. My public persona, I mean, it is how I feel in real life, but I have, you're right, a calmer approach. That's your approach and that's what you do and it works for you. I've seen you wake people up. I've seen Larkin wake people up with what he says and what he does. But I've also seen what I do and my approach wake a lot of people up in a very short amount of time. And I know that pouring a lot of positivity and giving hope where a lot of people are scared and confused and they think there's no hope and they don't know what's wrong. They just don't like society and they think it's messed up and they don't understand it. Well, what I do is I put the facts out there. I don't water it down. And if I do, it's not intentional. I don't think that I do. But I put more of a – I'm like the opposite of Cantwell. You put out there the
– Oh,
wait,
we all know
you're
a sweetheart.
The
it's
anger
okay.
And the brutality – not brutality, but you know what I mean. The you know, getting people riled up and getting them angry and doing all that. And as soon as they get angry, there has to be hope there somewhere. When there's no hope, people give up. So I guess it's my role – to give people that hope and put the positivity back into it. And I never lament or woe a death by a death of a police officer or a mercenary or a politician. However, I just don't rejoice in it and, you know, scream yay about it. That's my approach. And I feel as though that works pretty well for me.
It certainly is working out very well. And I'm glad that it is, no doubt.
Great.
Yeah, you know,
speaking
roles.
Yes, we do. So as I mentioned of Stefan Molyneux earlier, what are your chances do you think of him actually ever debating you, like you've been calling for about months now?
I think that at some point I'm going to become entirely too difficult to ignore, and I will get it. I don't know when that will be. You know, when I first made this call, I had only just launched my website. I had then and have now about 3,000 YouTube subscribers. I was fairly easy to ignore. Now that, you know, I'm creeping up on him in the Alexa rankings, I think that when I get back to New Hampshire and start making YouTube videos again, when I start making podcasts again, that I'm going to be much more difficult to ignore. Now I'm a contributor to LouRockwell.com. I'm a contributor to Economic Policy Journal. I'm a contributor to the Dollar Vigilante. I'm putting out, compelling content that people are finding, and they're realizing, unfortunately for my detractors, that, you know, it's much more difficult to spread rumors and badmouth somebody when they have their own platform. And what I've done is build a platform. So as that platform gets more and more difficult to ignore, the people who I approach, if they ignore me, they do so at the expense of their own credibility. And those who are interested in maintaining that said credibility, they will respond, you know, in time. But unfortunately, when I first made the call, my only claim to fame was really that I had 5,000 Facebook friends and a bunch of people were freaking out about me, you know. As time goes forward, that's less and less the case, that, you know, I'm more of a force to be reckoned with. And I think at some point Stefan will give in to that. Unfortunately, right now he probably thinks that I'm just somebody that he can ignore, and I hope to change that.
Because, you know, I definitely want to see that happen. It's nothing more, because I was just watching one of your YouTube videos in response to one of his podcasts. I posted an event page where he said, "Will the state just go away with a woe?" And you brought up a very interesting point. I'm actually, as used to be one of my favorites, but, you know, as time goes on, that when he's just advocating for peaceful parenting and not really, I know he's against defensive force. And also against electoral politics, which isn't really uncommon for an anarchist. And he's also against agorism. And I'm starting to really wonder whether he really wants a free society or not.
Well, it's an interesting thing. If you listen to Adam Kokesh and Stefan Molyneux they prefaced it as a debate, but it wasn't much of a debate. It was more of a discussion. And, you know, Adam said to Stefan, quote, "I think what you're missing is the how." Okay, end quote. So what he's saying is, you know, Adam's saying the same thing that I'm saying, is that there's no plan here. You know, there's no plan to achieve a free society. But also what Stefan says in that video is, he says the reason he focuses on peaceful parenting is, you know, that in order to achieve a free society, people are going to have to, like, act against their own interests at some point, right? So what he made the case of is, I want to see how serious people are about this. So peaceful parenting, and I support peaceful parenting, I just don't think it's a lone strategy to a free world. I just think it's a kind of too much importance is placed on it. But I absolutely oppose, you know, abusing children. But what he prefaced it as was, I want to see if people are serious. So if there's something that can, you know, bring us closer to a free society, let's look for something that's legal, right? And it's legal not to hit your kids. You're not legally required to hit your kids. Let's look for something that's socially acceptable, and it's certainly socially acceptable to not hit your kids. And it's easy to do. Some people might find it difficult not to spank their children, but I imagine that over time they would find that it, you know, actually worked out better. And it actually has positive results. It's not going to get you killed. It's not going to end you up in prison, right? And what Stefan said in that, and I think it's interesting, is that the resistance that he's met in peaceful parenting is his indication that people are not serious about building a free society, that this, that is easy to do, it's socially acceptable, it's not going to get you jammed up, and it has positive outcomes, that people won't even get on with that, right? That this is, that there's a lot of resistance even within the libertarian community to peaceful parenting. And there's two observations that I make from that. One, that, yeah, like, people are not actually that serious about building a free society. And two, that you're going to have to work, as a result, with a much smaller minority than it would take to do any of the things that Stefan Molyneux or any politico, approves of. Whether you think you're going to vote your way out of this or you're just going to raise a better generation of people, well, the evidence all points to that's going to be impossible, because not enough people actually care about it. What you're going to have to do is have a much smaller minority take much more drastic action to make the state impossible.
Right. Yeah. Agree with that. You have anything to add, Jesse?
Hello. I'm
here. You have anything to add to that?
I'm sorry. Oh no, I'm not too familiar with Stefan Molyneux and his peaceful parenting philosophy. So I really don't.
I encourage you to check him out. I mean, even if it's just to watch the YouTube videos, Stefan's a really interesting guy. He's a very compelling speaker, very, very talented guy, and really has a lot of really great explanations for how he envisions a free society working, very sound philosophical and economic arguments about what to do after the state is gone. However, my problem with him and with a lot of other people is that there is absolutely no plan, no intention even, of solving the problem, that they are really just enjoying their positions as content producers and activists, but they have no intention of solving this problem. Because to solve the problem would put them out of business, frankly, that it would take away their spotlight in a lot of cases. I don't know,
yeah,
you know, what motives
yeah.
are, of course. However,
that
you know,
is,
this seems a very common thing. You know, with Josie,
right.
we had spoken over the phone just a couple of weeks ago or something, you know, and you brought up this Larkins thing that, you know, if you could push this button and the problem would be solved, would you push it? And there's a lot of people in this movement who would not push that button because it would take away their status.
Yes.
Right.
Like,
and
go ahead.
Yeah. And when he first said that to me, because we were talking about, you know, a bunch of different things and, like you and I had spoken about, and I had talked about how I honestly wish it wasn't necessary that we had to do this, and I wish that the world were just the way it should be, and, you know, not perfect, clearly, it's never going to be perfect, but I wish I could go back to my job and not have to worry about, you know, doing this and trying to change people's minds, and it would be really great if I could spend my time, you know, in other ways. Not that I hate or resent what I do. I just, it would be nice if we didn't have to do it. And then that's when he brought that up. And it I noticed that with a lot of people, it's that this thing, it's what they've built their lives around. And what if all of a sudden we lived in a stateless society and we, you know, we didn't have to do what we're doing now? I feel like a lot of people would just be lost and confused and probably find something else to try to work towards or another cause to try to fix just to pass the time. And I could be wrong, and I can't presume to read people's minds, but I think you're absolutely right, especially when it comes to people saying, oh, no, we're probably never going to get to a free society. Okay, well, then why are you doing this then? Then why are you wasting all this time talking into a camera if you think that you are going to have zero effect for all of eternity? Why?
The answer to the question is because it draws attention to them. It's a way to make friends, and in a lot of cases, it's a way to make money. So, I mean, there's a lot of motives for getting involved in these circles that have nothing to do with solving the problem, and there's no shortage of reasons for that, and there's no shortage of people exploiting them.
Oh, absolutely. That was actually a rhetorical question. I knew the answer, but what I would pose to them. Like, why? That would be what I would say to someone who says to me, "Oh no, it'll never happen. It's just never ever going to happen." Okay, well then, that's what I would say. Well, why? Why are you doing it then? Why don't you just spend your time in other ways? Why don't you find another job, or why don't you go work here, work there? I mean, I made good money at my last job, and I, you know, I was totally secure and safe, but I just left. I couldn't do it anymore because it's just the world's going to shit, and I knew that I had something to say, and I started saying it. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's that, like we talked about, it's that big fish, little pond scenario, because right now we're in a very little pond, you know, and it's great to be the big fish because you get that ego boost and, you know, that attention, and which a lot of times makes me uncomfortable and blush and hide and run away and stutter and be silly, but that's why I have my solitude and my little place that I can just hide. So, yeah, absolutely. I would actually, I've seen some of Stefan's stuff. I watched him speak at Anarchy last year. You spoke there, too. I met a lot of great people there, and I just, I don't know. Maybe I'll look into some more of what he has to say.
Yeah, it's very interesting, compelling content, but you will not see the path outlined. The extent of it is really just raise a better generation. And, you know, the unfortunate fact of the matter is, with that strategy, is that for every one of us that is born, thousands of statists are born, tens, hundreds of thousands.
Yes.
And
right.
They are raised in public schools, and they are told that soldiers and police are the saviors of mankind and that politicians are the wisest amongst us. And this is what is going to happen with the majority of people until the state ceases to exist. And this is a glaring hole in all of the, you know, the, if you will, peace propagandists that, you know, the peace at all costs, the appeasement crowd. Unfortunately, that's the glaring hole in all of that stuff, and it's interesting to try to tease out the cognitive dissonance in them, because they refuse to accept the obvious nature of the hole in their story, you know, and they'll just keep going. And whether it's because they genuinely don't realize it or because they have other motives, I can't speak to that, but it's glaringly obvious, unfortunately. And I'm still glad to have them doing these things, right? Because I mean, spreading the message is a great thing, and however they do it and why ever they do it, I'm still happy to have them doing it. I certainly don't want to chase anybody out of the movement. But I do get concerned when people think that some of these folks, deities and saviors, that you know, there's some cult worship surrounding folks like Stefan Molyneux and Ron Paul, you know. And if I do, you know, perceive there to be some detriment in that, even if the benefit outweighs the detriment.
Oh, absolutely, and I would never. Yeah, I absolutely appreciate what you know, people like Stefan and Ron Paul have done and are doing. I don't want to make it seem like I dislike them or don't want to associate with them in any way, shape, or form. I think it's great, but I honestly didn't know that was something that Stefan stated, that there will never be a free society.
Stefan does not say that there won't be a free society. Stefan pursues a path that guarantees that there will not be, right? That basically his thing is he doesn't outright reject defensive force, but if put to any practical scenario, he'll try to get around it, frankly. And what he says is that, you know, it's a multi-generational path through the raising of future generations to reject violence is the idea. And it's basically, it's all about, you know, just raising your kids better. And that's the problem. Stefan doesn't say that there won't be a free society, but his path, in my opinion, at least, assures that there never will be. It's going to require use of force by some segment of the population at some point. And very few people, unfortunately, want to accept that.
Okay, then I definitely misunderstood, because that's what got me on that rant. why are people talking about this and then not, you know, with no intention of ever getting a free society? And, you know, I'm well aware that there's a good chance that it may not happen in my lifetime, but I know that if it doesn't happen in my lifetime, that I'm definitely trying to contribute to laying a foundation for it happening in future lifetimes. So.
Certainly.
Yeah, that's also, I'd say, detrimental in the fact that I don't like the word utopian, as especially became more derogatory in libertarian circles, especially. But you know, I'd say that's exactly what kind of impression that, you know, his method definitely gives across. Because I mean, if we're just going to raise kids, eventually we're going to have to be perfect in order to actually to achieve it. Then you know, that's going to really turn people off, because they're just going to think that, well, we're just never going to be fit for a free society. I think you read that one of your earlier articles.
Yeah. I think that there's, unfortunately, even in libertarian circles, I believe that there's a lot of victim blaming that goes on that says that, you know, that we're not fit for this, you know, that we as a people must be better and then we can have freedom. And I think that that's just plain nonsense, that the worst mankind is the more you need to abolish the state, because obviously if there's a bunch of evil, shitty people walking into voting booths, that's my one curse word for the interview, then that's all the more reason that this problem needs to be solved. Because if you have a bunch of terrible, evil people going and voting in, you know, psychopaths who will do unspeakable amounts of violence, then that's a really strong motivator for good people to put a stop to that. And I think that, you know, in the absence of the state, that people are just going to sort of go along. I think that they're just going to, you know, do what they've always done, which is get up and go to work in the morning and you know, ask someone else what they want them to do. I don't think that we're going to really have a situation where, you know, the government ceases to exist and then people just go into full-on panic mode and starve and riot. I don't think that that's realistic. I think that people are going to get up and go to work just like they did the day before, and the smart people, the entrepreneurs of the world, will start reorganizing things in a market fashion. And that's anyway my goal. I think that this idea that, you know, you're going to have an orderly dissolution of the state, that it's going to go away because there's some wide mass awakening, some global paradigm shift, you know, that kind of strategy is unfortunately going to leave us wanting for liberty for generations to come.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that there will be, and I know that you said, Chris, you know, I think people are going to go up and go, you know, get up and go to work like they normally do and you know, such and such. I think that there, you know, say there was an immediate dissolution of the state all at once. I think that there most certainly will be growing pains, you know, especially, I would say, mostly within, you know, neighborhoods where crime is high to begin with. I don't even like to put it that way. And I'm not saying that these people are going to go and start, you know, raping and pillaging the entire world. But I think there will be a little bit of growing pains. People are probably going to be a little confused, especially if it's just an immediate dissolution of the government. I think people will be a little confused, and they're going to – there are a lot of people who depend on the government to keep them safe and who see the government as a safe haven. And I think a lot of people will be very confused and a little bit scared, and I think it will eventually get to the point that you previously stated – but I think there will definitely be growing pains in the process.
I could see there being some growing pains, but I think in the, you know, in your high crime neighborhoods and stuff like that, I think that in the high crime neighborhoods that your criminals would probably get killed pretty quickly. I don't think that they'd survive long in that environment at all, because when people don't have 911 to call, they will deal with these people with you know, extreme prejudice, that they will put these people down like dogs in the street to maintain order in their society when the state is not there to do it. And once that starts happening, once there's no more revolving door of the criminal justice system and you're worried about going to jail for defending your home, I think that very quickly crime is going to stop in these places. Not stop entirely. You know, of course, there's always going to be some criminal element in society, but I think that in the absence of the state, very, very quickly, that those problems would resolve themselves.
Oh, and I agree, because at that point, people will realize that they have to take justice into their own hands. Absolutely. But all I'm saying is that it's not going to be as seamless as I took it, as you said it would be.
Right. And I'll add also to Chris's point, also, you would have no more gun control laws, too, so... One more,
but of course, as Josie points out, I mean, in the places where in the places where there's high crime, there has been gun control typically. So the regular citizens of that society won't have immediate access to firearms. So I mean, I could see that being like one of your growing pains. That you know, unfortunately, in these high crime areas, the only people who have the guns are the bad people, and that could certainly cause a certain amount of trouble in the society. However, you know, so yeah, I'll agree with a certain amount of growing pains, but I think that markets will solve that very quickly in that, oh, well, I have guns and these people don't. So, you know, arbitrage, you know, people are going to go run over there and sell weapons to these people really fast. So,
right.
You know, a certain amount of growing pains, I'll agree with that, but they'll correct it quickly.
Absolutely. Okay. And I do think they will correct themselves. But it's like, you know, I hate, like you said, like Eric said, that the word utopia is silly, and I hate when people put it out there as it being an immediate utopia that all we have to do is ignore the state and it'll dissolve and, you know, we'll just live in utopia. I think eventually it will be a place that is, the world will be a place where there's a lot, oh God, just exponentially less murder, extortion, and theft, whatever you name it. But, like, I mean, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but it'll take a little bit before we get there. But I absolutely agree that eventually, and not too long before it will be that way.
Okay. Real quickly, I'm going to go take one real quick break real quick. And, yeah, we'll be right back.
Did you know most Americans know nothing or very little about the legal system? I am the Rose Colombo, longtime legal activist, legal coach, legal advocate, and the author of Fight Back Legal Abuse, Irwin Award winner, and also my latest political satire, Obamacare Dinosaurs, Rednecks, and Radicals, a political satire exposing the evil agendas of Obamacare and redistribution of wealth that leaves you with a thought-provoking ending. Will mankind survive, or will the U.S. natural-born citizen become extinct? It's available at Amazon.com. You can also visit my website at www.fightbacklegalabuse.com for more information. So order your copy today and empower yourself with knowledge before injustices come knocking on your back door unexpectedly.
Welcome back to For Whom the Bell Tolls. I am joined by Christopher Cantwell and Josie Wells, a.k.a. Josie the Outlaw. Okay, since I haven't really asked any questions directly to you, Josie, I'm really interested in how you actually came into libertarianism. Where most of us looks like we've gone through for a political route first, or just by Ron Paul or Libertarian Party. But most of your videos, you seem like just totally ignored that, and mainly just through philosophy in general.
Well, that's not entirely. I guess it's kind of true, not entirely true. I've always had these feelings. I was lucky enough to be. I'll try to shorten this. I was lucky enough to be raised in a family, a wonderful family, that pretty much counteracted the indoctrination. And you know, I went through my phases of petitioning and protesting and marching on DC and doing all that activism. But you know, even when I was younger, my father used to try to get me to vote. And I would always tell him it just didn't make a difference. I used to say, when I first turned 18, and that was when the GPS, I guess, just 12 years ago, I think GPS was first, introduced into cars and such. But I remember saying, or actually no, it was a tracking device. I remember saying that to my father. I said, if you can attach a tracking device to my actual vote and I can see it go and make a difference, and I can see where it lands, then I'll vote. And I never, like, I registered because, to keep my father happy. I voted twice, and both times I wrote my father in. That was what I did. and it was just one of those, I knew it was just, I was only going through the steps, and, that was that, so. I've definitely been, I remember being 13 years old and reading a fictional book. It was a Christian series called Left Behind. And I started reading it, and there was a lot of religious stuff in there about the rapture and this and that. But it was very good reading, and I got hooked, and I started seeing like all of these things in this fictional series that were actually happening around me. And I just thought, okay, that's it. This world is just not where it should be. I am totally against government, totally against politicians. I would always tell my parents that it didn't matter. My father was a Republican. I would always tell them that it didn't matter who was in office, they were going to make the same decisions no matter what, and the same things were going to happen. Now, you know, fast forward to, I don't know. I've always had these feelings. It's just, and I spent from the time I was 13 to my mid-20s just researching, and I went through that, you know, crazy party, doing what I got to do phase, and I had the corporate job, and I flew all over, and I was this, and I was that. But it's when I, you know, sat down on YouTube or whatever I read, it was always, you know, 1984 or Animal Farm or those kind of books or YouTube videos about the, you know, the Illuminati and this and that. And, you know, that was my entertainment. And, of course, I watched the ridiculous, you know, TV shows that are on cable and this and that. But that was, I guess, me just, I wasn't ready. I guess I had a lot of research and honing of my philosophy to do. And I would always talk about how just, the government was horrible and disgusting, and it was never going to get better and only getting worse, and there was no reason to vote, and it was never a good idea. But I didn't know, everyone I would talk to would just, I was the only one who was saying these things in my circles and with my friends, and they always just kind of just said, you know what, you're crazy, you're paranoid, you're this and you're that. And I honestly didn't know until a little over a year ago that there was a term for the way I felt, and it was anarchism, because, you know, I did fall victim to the indoctrination of, you know, hearing anarchy and thinking chaos and murder and theft and all of these things. And then once I finally started researching anarchism and voluntarism, I thought that's what it is. That's what I want, and that's what I've been wanting. So, after getting pretty heavily involved in the Philadelphia activist community, I started to see that, and activism is great, and going to these events and protests is great for networking and talking to people and, you know, motivating other people and learning from other people's philosophies. But I started to realize not too long after being heavily involved that it wasn't actually making a huge difference, that standing with a sign and screaming at DHS agents and being tossed around by riot police, I felt that wasn't making the difference that I wanted to make, or it wasn't having the effect that I thought needed to be had. So then Larkin Rose asked me to help him with a project that I think he's still doing. But as we're talking and he's asking me questions and kind of doing this little playing devil's advocate thing, and finally, he just said, all right, put that on hold. I just want to start, let's start getting what you're, we have the same philosophy almost, like almost the same philosophy. Let's just get it out there. You know, I can help word it at first so that, you know, I have 20 years of experience of debating status and this and that. And he used his experience to kind of poke holes in what I would say, and then we went through this intense writing process, and that's how the project got launched initially. So,
thanks.
Yeah.
That's interesting you brought up Left Behind. I guess now that you're so remembering that, it's now I'm confused as why so many Christians are statists. Interesting.
I would say Catholic. I will put it this way, and I know Chris has an interesting take on Christians and, you know, people who call themselves Christians. And I would call myself a Christian in the way, and this is what I've always said, in the way that I don't care if he's fake, if he's made up, if he's real. I live the way, I try to live the way that Christ lived in his actions and a lot of what he did, and a lot of what he did, not all of it, in the way that he, you know, confronted the Philippines, which was the government at the time. He called them out. You know, he really just didn't abide by the rules of society at that point, and was very compassionate and accepting, and basically just wanted to spread the word of basically freedom. And I know that a lot of what the Bible says, I can't take the Bible seriously. I'm really sorry. I can't. I kind of use it loosely and interpret it loosely. But I basically call myself a Christian in the way that people who like Star Trek call themselves Trekkies. Like, I know that it may not be true. I don't know. I have no way to know. All I know is that I kind of dig a lot of the things that he did, and I do like the way that I was raised, and I don't mind calling myself a Christian. Now, should other, you know, pure Christians and Catholics and whoever they are denounce me? Absolutely. Go right ahead. That's fine. This is how I feel, and that's, you know, this is how I, that's how I feel about the topic, and they can interpret it however they'd like. But the term Christian absolutely doesn't define me, and I don't live my life. I don't walk around telling people I'm a Christian, and, you know, you should be a Christian too. It's just that, you know.
Okay. Okay, we got a caller real quick. I'll see what that person has to say. Area code 562, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello, caller.
Hello, caller. Hi. Okay, well, sorry, Mr. Opportunity. Okay.
He's probably listening on the radio, which is the dumbest mistake that you can make as a radio call-in guest. If anybody else is thinking about calling, when you call, you have to listen through your phone, because if you listen on the radio, there's a delay. And then when you do come on, you will be echoing, and we are not going to tolerate that. We'll hang up on you. The other rule for when you call into a radio show is to never ask the host, how you doing? Because everybody who calls into the radio says, hey, how you doing? And, you know, little do you know that he started off the show saying, hey, I'm feeling good today. So those are the rules for calling into a radio show, and hopefully you'll follow them next time, sir.
I would honestly like to hear Chris's take on my view on Christianity. I'm curious.
I do not understand why you would still want to associate yourself with that term, because you basically just went and like threw away everything that term ever meant, and then just decided to call yourself that anyway, because obviously, you know, Christianity is a religion. You know, it's based on a book, right? You can identify the source of this word, right? And it comes from this book. And you say, well, I'm gonna act, you know, the way Jesus did. Okay, so are you going to, you know, go and run around and tell people, you know, hey, go forth and sin no more because they, you know, did some sexual things that, you know, weren't, you know, necessarily in line with society? Are you going to, you know, are you going to die and come back from the dead? Are you going to turn the other cheek? I hope that, you know, you don't think that you're going to go ahead and do any of these things. And that's not, you know, what a religion is, that you just pick and choose, you know, the parts that you do or you do not like. So, you know, you can call yourself a unicorn for all I care. I mean, you have every right to do that. I just don't understand why you still want to associate yourself with the term, you know. And it does go back, I do get a little annoyed about it when people do that, because I think that words matter, right? Like, you know, the assault on language that we're suffering from in this society is absolutely one of the worst things that we could do, and that's why I get so pissed off at these people who call themselves libertarians and aren't libertarians. I can imagine that people who, you know, take the Bible very seriously get rather upset when people call themselves Christians and then just say that they threw out the book.
I guess I can understand that. However, yeah. I honestly, I don't know. I'm taking it. And like I said, not everything he said and did in that book I agree with.
But he's a fucking deity, right? Like, I'm sorry, that was my second curse word. But like, he's God. You know what I'm saying? Like, why am I going to call myself a Christian, which necessarily like implies like a belief in an all-powerful deity, and then just like say, you know, screw him. You know, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me.
I'm not saying screw him, and I actually don't see him as a god or a deity or any of that. I mean, he was what they call him in the Bible is human and divine. Okay, great. However,
that's a
I don't
god, but
right, this quote unquote the son of God. Okay. However, I will not let go of that at this point. I don't know though. I'm going to call myself a Christian. Chris Cantwell, deal with it.
All right. You know, like I said, you can call yourself a unicorn if you want, but that just doesn't make you a unicorn, right? So, like,
I'm a damn Christian unicorn.
As far as the divinity of Jesus, like, you know, this is one of those paradoxes that it exists in the Bible. If you read the book, you know that he refers to himself both as God and as the Son of God. So, I mean, if Jesus is not a liar, then he is God and he is God's son at the same time, which, you know, hey, you know, it's the Bible. We're talking about magic and deities and stuff, so I guess anything is possible. But he is God and he is his own son. That's what the Bible says.
I understand that, but the thing is, I have a hard time taking the Bible word for word since it's been translated over and over and over again and written by people forever and ever and ever and ever ago. So,
but it was divinely inspired, so it's necessarily infallible, and this is carried down throughout the ages. Sorry?
I don't believe that it's infallible in any way, shape, or form. That's ridiculous.
Well, you're not much of a Christian, then.
Okay.
Even my former co-host from Some Garbage Podcast, Eddie Dunn, right? So, like, Eddie is a guy who, you know, calls himself a Christian, and he certainly does not live by the word of the book, right? But he believes it. He's like, I am totally screwed because I believe in this, and I'm disobeying it anyway, right? So Eddie is just so, like, convinced that, like, he's just going to, you know, live his life and be completely screwed for doing so. And I think that's just so strange, you know, that, like, he doesn't even try to, like you probably behave like more of a Christian than Eddie does, but Eddie, you know, actually believes in the book. So, like, I almost have to, like, call him a Christian more than you, who tries to behave more Christ-like, you know? It's impossible to come to any sort of rational conclusion, because we're necessarily, by picking up this book and trying to rationally analyze it, we are bound for failure, right? Like, there is no possibility for us to come to any sort of rational conclusion where the premise of the book is that there's a God who just created the world in 7 days, and he's a really swell guy, but he decided to drown the entire planet, and that mankind is just screwed from the beginning of time because some chick picked an apple, and that then the deity goes and he says, well, things are really screwed up down there, and I better go fix it by impregnating this virgin and giving birth to myself. So we're totally screwed if we're trying to have a rational discussion about it from the beginning, and I sort of know that whenever I start talking.
I know. Speaking of
Eddie, you know, I did start warming up. I started warming up to him when I realized that you're both getting extremely, extremely drunk during some garbage podcast. You know, I had this. I was actually wondering if that was just an act, if you were just actually paying him. Just to, so that portray make anarchists look so stupid, which I don't really understand, because I mean their philosophy is very incoherent as it is.
Eddie was not a paid actor. I mean, he was my business partner, and he's my friend. Like, I've known Eddie since we're kids, and you know, he's kind of an out there guy. And the funny thing was that, you know, the audience was really roughly split 50-50. You know, that there was a lot of, you know, argument. If you look at the YouTube comments, people were arguing about each other about, you know, Eddie's, you know, right on, and Cantwell's so wrong, and, you know, oh, Cantwell's totally owning Eddie right now. Like, the opinion was totally split, and I think that it made for a really interesting program, because, I certainly, you know, brought more, like, of a pre-existing audience to the program, but people really warmed up to Eddie very, very rapidly, and it was this total... Every YouTube video that we have of Some Garbage Podcast, the comments that follow are just people who absolutely seem to hate each other, because we're just such polarizing figures on either side of these, you know, issues of, you know, minarchy versus anarchy and atheism versus Christianity. People are so split over it that they would argue with each other, and there'll be 500 comments of just people fighting with each other. And it just sort of worked out that way. So no, Eddie's not an actor. He believes this stuff. And the reason that I started Some Garbage Podcast was because we were doing this by ourselves, right? We'd be in the office, we'd work all day, and then we'd be hanging out in the office, you know, have a couple of drinks or whatever, and start screaming at each other. And I was like, this is entertaining content. We have to give this to the world.
Nice. Nice.
Eddie used to like me. And now he has hated me and blocked me.
Eddie has like blocked and unblocked so many different people, and you know, I don't know why he resorts to blocking. I understand why other people block him, because he can be a really vicious troll. But like I would say give that a little bit of time, because Eddie's a good guy to know, and it's fun to have him you know, chiming in from time to time.
Yeah, no, I've always liked a lot of his comments and stuff. What the reason it was because I gave, you know, the whole Lauren Beth Faulkner thing. I gave her chance after chance after chance, and then when it was evident that she stole the money, I called her out on it and had proof, and he did not like it for some reason.
Yeah, he was trying to get me to jump in on her side, and I was like, I hate this woman to begin with, and then she goes and steals some money. I am not jumping in on her side. I'm going to do the exact opposite. And we were going to, at one point, have her on the show, and we ended up canceling the show. And it was going to be fun to have her on, because I think like Eddie was going to try to take her side, and I was going to rip her a new asshole. And it was going to be a lot of fun, but like we had moved offices and didn't have our studio set up, and ended up parting ways as business partners shortly after. So it was unfortunate that we never got to have that. But yeah, he tried to get me to jump in on that thing too, and I'm like, look at this, dude, it's track marks in her calendar shoot, you know. Lauren Beth Faulkner, she's a female cop blocker, was involved in the Ladies of Cop Block calendar, and she was like responsible for the money. And you know, all of a sudden it was impossible to come up with said funds, and this became a rather big stink with the ladies that Josie could probably tell you more about, but I figured I'd jump in with what I know.
Well, okay. It is it's a long story, but basically it just, once the issue of money came up, and it was sketchy from the beginning, I will tell you that. It was very unorganized, and she really didn't answer very many questions. And when concerns were voiced, it was always, you know, blown off or put off on someone else. And then when it came to the issue of money, I actually defended her and went out of my way to try to neutralize the situation and do everything I could to try to get on her side. And I spoke to her, and, you know, her and Janelle and I wrote a three-way conversation on the phone. We have all of this documented. And then she said she was giving refunds, tomorrow they'll be back, tomorrow they'll be back, tomorrow they'll be back. Well, 3 months later, they still weren't back to anyone. And then she disappeared off the face of the earth with all of the money. So at that point, that was when I would randomly, you know, every couple weeks, kind of comment on a status, oh, hey, Laura. Just checking on you. Hope you're okay. Hey, did you find that money? And that's when, you know, the random person would chime in and say, oh, you're just stirring up drama. So it's just trying to hold someone accountable for money that was given in good faith by supporters of Cop Block.
It looks like we might have a caller real quick. I'm going to see what this person has to say. Oh, 915, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
Go 915.
Larry. No, it's
oh,
not
awesome.
Me. I swear. I am not me. I swear.
Okay.
If you try to accuse me of being me, I'll deny it in court.
Okay. Oh, okay.
What are y'all talking about anyway? What's Cop Block?
The Cop Block? Cop Block is an organization that is more of a police accountability organization. They film cops. And if they do any shady type of shit, they you know, they post it on YouTube. There's my one curse word for the show.
You need to put a quarter in the cuss jar. Sorry, man. Go on.
Okay, I'll do that.
No ice cream for dinner either. You're like cut off from dessert. Sorry. Yeah, it's bad boy. Yep.
All right. Well, okay.
Anyway, hi, folks. Now, who's all with you here? Because I'm like, I just called in. I'm like kind of in.
Oh, you and know. You just didn't mean actually press the button and say, well, I'm going
don't
with
call
Christopher.
Into a radio show and ask what the topic of discussion is. It's not how calling into a radio show works.
Hey, I didn't raise my hand and be called in. I was drafted. Don't get on my case, Ace.
You're drafted. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, he's
okay.
Forced me
well, anyway, this
situation.
Is Christopher Cantwell and in Josie Wales. You may know her as Josie the Outlaw.
Well, that's kind of funny because I use Josie Wales as a internet name of sorts sometimes. But that's another story. I used to use that
be weird.
Back when Freedomizer had a different chat room. Instead of using a real name, because, you know, you don't use your real name on the internet.
Well, interesting.
Anyway,
okay.
It's kind of funny, but go ahead. Yes, what?
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I was just listening.
Yeah, thank you.
As far as accountability for cops, yeah, somebody that stole money that was supposed to be trusted, bad. And I'm not making a joke about ice cream either. That is like, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Oops. I guess he must have accidentally pressed one. But, yeah. Well, anyway, it looks like we're just about out of time, and I want to thank both of you for joining me. It was very entertaining. And I guess he's like that. If you have anything you'd like to plug, go on ahead before we part ways.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. ChristopherCantwell.com is the website. You'll find my Twitter, my Facebook, my YouTube, all that great stuff and all the crazy antics I'm up to on a regular basis. Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to engaging with your audience.
Thank you, Chris.
And I would also like to thank you for having us on. I was really looking forward to it because I'm glad that we called in because I always love talking to Chris, and it was great talking to you. I guess my website is josietheoutlaw.com, and yeah, that's pretty much it.
Thank you, guys, and so concludes another episode of For Whom the Bell Tolls. Please stay tuned next for Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. All right, good night, guys. Bye.
Hi, I have a question for you. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Do you want a company that provides good quality ingredients and does not use artificial sweeteners? Look no further. Genesis Pure has a complete lineup of health and wellness, sports performance, and superfruit juices like Noni and Mangosteen that are pure, wild harvested with no binders and fillers. The philosophy is simple. Cleanse the body of toxins, balance the body's pH and hormones, and build the body nutritionally. Every race has a starting line, and yours is Cleanse, Balance, Build. Sign up for at least a 25% discount and include auto ship of at least one product to start building up 20% back in points for free products. It's a win-win. Help fund our operation while you fund your body nutritionally. Start your journey at genesispure.com/freedomizerhealth. Again, that is genesispure.com/freedomizerhealth.
Okay. Hello, everybody. This is Cindy Lake, and you are listening to Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. It is Tuesday, May 20th, 2014, and we are doing a free-for-all tonight, meaning there's no show been planned. We do have a special guest who just walked in my studio/house door. And that would be Jason Smith, candidate for Clark County Commission District F. He'll be joining us on the show tonight. But I do welcome you to call in to 347-324-3704 and join in on the conversation.
Again, that number is 347-324-3704. Today, May 20th, is a really big day for candidates running for office in Clark County. Those of us who have primaries, early voting starts on Saturday, May 24th. Today is the last day to register partisan office, Republican or Democrat, to vote for me and any other candidate who is running for a partisan office. Today is the last day to register and or switch. So it's a big day, and it's also a day to file our contributions and expense reports to show how much money we've raised and how much we've spent. I can tell you folks that I am running an extremely fiscally conservative primary campaign at the moment, and I'm very pleased and proud with what I've been able to do with a little bit. I've always been told that it takes a lot of money to win a race, and I don't believe that's necessarily true. However, we shall see what happens in the next couple of months after the primary is over. And if all things are as what I think they are, I will be running against Mary Beth Scow, who is the incumbent in my District G. And last I checked, she had about $300,000. It's probably a lot more by now. Waiting to see what her report says. However, I don't expect it to even be there because I looked for her 2010 contributions and expense report, and it is nowhere to be seen. So we're trying to get to the bottom of that. But in any case, if you're a candidate and would like to join in on the conversation and get your word out about yourself, please feel free to call us tonight, 347-324-3704. I'm going to play a Jordan Page song for about 3-4 minutes, and then we'll come back with Jason Smith, who is running for Clark County Commission District F. And we will start the show in about 4 minutes. Enjoy Jordan Page. Listen.
Listen to the sound that you hear, like it echoes. Now, from the heart of America. This is the ghost of Vietnam through a veil of napalm. Don't forget your mistakes and where you came from.
Everybody, we're back. Thanks for listening in to Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. And it is Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. Looks like I have a caller calling in. Let's see who's calling in and joining us on the air. Hi, you're on the air with Cindy.
That would be me.
And who is
Hello?
Me?
Mark.
Mark. Hi, Mark.
Yeah. Hi, how are you, Cindy? You're doing a free for all, so some kind of open discussion. Right?
Yep, open discussion.
Yeah, and I felt compelled to join.
Well, thank you for joining. Thanks for listening. So, what do you want to talk about?
Interest rates.
Oh, what are
but
they?
No,
really,
actually, if you think about it, in so many ways. All of the problems that we talk about are sub problems of interest rates. So, you know, actually, in a sense, we should be spending more time talking about interest rates because if the government got out of the business of controlling interest rates, we wouldn't have the spending problem going on, and. Of course, government wouldn't be nearly as big as it is, and we'd have a free market and a whole lot of liberty.
You know, I think you're right in that we shouldn't even talk about the Federal Reserve because, as we both know, I mean, you sound like a Mises Institute-trained fellow. As those of us who pay attention know, it's really the Federal Reserve, but if you break it down for the average person – the average person can understand interest rates better more than they can understand the Federal Reserve. Is that what you're getting to? Is that what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, and it's not even so much the Federal Reserve because, you know, if it wasn't the Federal Reserve, then, you know, if it was the Treasury, you know, it'd be, you know, equally a problem. In fact, let me tell you, I've been a long time you know, activist for on behalf of liberty and free markets and laissez-faire. And every now and then I'll listen to, you know, somebody like Alex Jones, mainly to see what he's saying. I mean, I agree with a lot of what he's saying, but when it comes to economics, he's absolutely horrible. And I've always had this pet peeve. And let me tell you, it feels so good to get on here and take part in this conversation because I think in many ways I've had a lot of anxiety over, you know, feeling like there's nobody to talk to about, you know, real issues like this. But to get back to what I was saying here, you know, this problem I have with Alex Jones is he'll start going out on the Federal Reserve and he'll say that the problem with it is that it's a private for-profit institution. And I almost cringe because, you know, the fact of the matter is it's not really a private bank. It's the government central bank. It is governed by political forces. It has nothing to do with the free market. And, you know, if you start getting into – if your criticism of the Fed is that it's private, then objectively what you're saying, you're getting into this, you know, like Bill Still level crankism – you know, this whole idea that, well, what we need to do is take Janet Yellen, her position, and subordinate it to the Secretary of the Treasury and just let the Congress inflate itself and streamline the whole process of inflation and make it easier for these guys to inflate. And that's the last thing that I would say needs to be done. So the problem is not that the Federal Reserve is private. It is the government central bank, and it's certainly not a for-profit institution, because if it were a private for-profit institution, it wouldn't be extending credit at negative real rates. And by negative real rates, we're talking about nominal rates that are outstripped by, you know, true inflation, which is, of course, the expansion of the money supply, i.e. the, you know, creation of money out of thin air. That is what inflation is. And when the Fed inflates like that, this artificially lowers not just nominal rates by increasing the supply of loanable funds, but it also lowers the real rate of interest by allowing debtors, for example, the government, to pay back creditors, borrowers to pay back lenders with devalued dollars. You know, look at it like this. If the nominal rate is 3, 4, 5%, but inflation is going about 8, 9, 10%, well, that's a negative rate of return in real terms. The Fed has been extending, you know, interest-free credit, has been extending credit at negative real rates. The Fed is objectively bankrupt. It's not a for-profit institution, but I wish it were. But
you might be losing some people here. You're going a little fast, but I get what you're saying, of course, but the average listener might not, although we are mostly like-minded folks who listen to this show and Freedomizer Radio in general. But Mark, why don't you slow it down just a little bit, because you said
interest rate. I apologize.
No, that's okay, because it's intriguing, and I really do think that that is the best way to present the argument to the average person, because, again, like you said, it doesn't matter, Treasury, Federal Reserve, but when the Federal Reserve is printing, creating money out of thin air and devaluing the dollar and keeping interest rates effectively at zero, at least for international borrowers, then how is the saver punished?
Well, the saver is punished because you're not generating any kind of return on savings. If you take funds and try to hold on to them, you know, you're going to come out about the same as if you tried to save milk for any, you know, lengthy period of time. The value of the dollar is being eroded. So you will for surely lose by trying to hold dollars. So it's like you're forced to speculate. You're forced to try to do something other than just hold cash. And so that's one way that savers are punished. And of course, if you undermine savers, you're going to undermine the fundamentals of the economy, because it's impossible savings are what funds investment. This idea that savings, we don't need savings, we don't need to worry about savers, yet at the same time we can have investment is nonsense. It's savings that funds investment. And look at it like this: in order to sustain the process of production, you know, producers need to be able to consume. You want to, say you're in the business of making bread, say you're a bread maker. In order to make bread, you yourself have to eat. And so that's why investment can only come out of savings. Savings funds investment. And now, of course, what we're doing is we've turned upside down time preferences, and we've made it more advantageous to go out and spend today rather than save for the future. And so we destroy the incentives to save, and inflation, it speeds up consumption, and it destroys savings. It wipes out savings and suppresses interest rates on one motion, which is incredibly wicked. Now, look at it like this. When people think about interest rates, they think wholly in terms of a financial transaction. And I'm trying to think of a good way to explain this here. Okay, if you – okay, say you,
if you
want –
if you don't mind for a second, Mark, I have to interrupt you too because we have somebody else on hold for about 20 right. minutes, and you're doing a great job. If you don't mind staying on, I'm going to allow this other guest to join in as well. And I wanted to say, too, that we have Jason Smith here. Jason Smith is a candidate for Clark County Commission District F, as in Frank, and I'm going to let Jason take it over in just a minute. I'm just going to bring whoever this is waiting. I don't know who it is waiting. And then we'll all be able to talk about interest rates and other things as well. So hang on one second. Okay, caller
911
area code. Larry Wright?
Yeah, Larry Wright.
The Larry I know. Hi, Larry. How are you? I don't
just
think Larry. We've ever spoken.
Yes, we have. You just don't remember. You have too busy
have
of a
we?
Life.
Okay.
I've talked to you
oh, okay.
on this show. I've talked to you on your own show. In
oh,
fact,
you
one
have.
Of your
okay.
first shows even. Yeah. But that's okay.
Oh, okay.
Hey.
All right. Well, hi, Larry. Thanks for joining in.
Hi. You bet.
He sounds like a fellow Northerner.
No, I'm not a Northerner. I know Yankee. Let's not get insulting, okay?
No, I'm not trying to
Texas.
Insult you. I'm from Minnesota.
It was
Minnesota.
A joke. Lighten up, bro. Lighten up, all right? Lighten up. But I do have to correct you on something. One, interest rates are not the problem. The problem is, and you need to do more research because you're incorrect on something very badly. Federal Reserve is owned by a private consortium or a cabal, if you will. Now, granted, there are stocks involved, but overall, the vast majority of the controller part of the stock is the elitist globalists of the world, the banksters, if you will, that they're actually more than just banksters. And the list is pretty exclusive. You know, if you're not a Rothschild, a Rockefeller, or Queen Elizabeth or such, you're kind of not in on the party, okay? And this is verifiable fact. This isn't my opinion. But anyway, their best interest is not our best interest. Over time, and they write this in their memoirs, their ancestors told how they were going to go about doing things. They wanted to usurp this country, take it over, and knew that they couldn't do it gun against gun. They tried with Andrew Jackson and kind of got their backside whipped, and they tried with the War of 1812 and the Colonial Wars, because the Colonial Wars were more than what people really think. But all that aside, the Rothschilds, for example, knew and had a philosophy that Cindy?
Hello. I'm sorry. I was trying to listen and also let you guys know that there was somebody else holding, and I do have a guest here as well, so I wanted to kind of try to – I know it is a free-for-all, and I appreciate it.
All right,
I'll
wrap it up real quick. Okay, I'm sorry.
I agree with you. The Federal Reserve is wholly privately owned, and I do – also agree that if we talk about interest rates to the average person rather than talking about the Federal Reserve and the Rothschilds, we might be able to get through to people better than to bring up this other ancillary stuff that we're talking about. So that's just my opinion.
If we really, you know, if we went back to the way the founders started things, we wouldn't have so-called interest rates that we, the people, would have to worry about. Borrowers from other countries, yes. Okay.
Well, first of all,
hold on a second. The Treasury prints the money, okay? Then gives it to the Federal Reserve. Then the Federal Reserve, in turn, loans us back the money, and that is where we pay interest on the taxpayer.
But who?
Okay.
Right. But who tells them to print the money?
Yeah. Really. Yeah. Well, we pay for the money to be printed.
But who tells them to print the money? And why?
The Federal Reserve tells them to print money, not the Congress
anymore.
Congress,
where do they come in? Where does Congress?
They don't anymore. The Congress, the Congress goes on their knees going, can we audit you? The Federal Reserve says no, and they go, okay, goodbye.
Well,
don't tell me the Congress
to...
runs the show. Dude, wake up.
Well,
I mean,
no,
really.
It's not the Congress. They're the puppets, too. They're the puppets. They're a puppet masters. But you know what? Anything
look at what
Congress
Greenspan
wants, they can have.
Well, what
they
I'm getting
have, they don't
on an interview
they don't
want
to go to their constituents and say we have to raise your taxes. They say we're going to give you new roads, 60 new road projects. And we're not even going to raise your taxes.
Income tax we pay doesn't even go towards anything except the Federal Reserve. Buy tires or car parts or gasoline tax, that theoretically goes towards fixing roads. Although some states
okay, let's propose
fund.
This question. I'm gonna have Jason propose this question to you guys. Hold on 1 second. Go ahead, Jason.
What would happen if every county balanced their budget without the use of federal agency grants and cut that $400 billion out of the federal deficit spending every year through those agency grants?
Well, I would say that communities would... I was going to say, I would say that communities would have a lot more autonomy over their decision-making process because one point I tried to make many years ago when I ran for a municipal office in another state was that, it's not a net benefit to the community to receive state funding, federal funding. Every community does the same thing, and by the time we all get done, every community is subsidizing every other community. So each community is subsidizing each other. And with that comes the loss of control how the money is allocated. Nobody ends up any better off. Of course, as individuals, it's the same idea that we all fight for our subsidy. We end up subsidizing each other, and then with it, we lose control over our personal lives. And so I would say that the first thing is that communities are going to have a lot more autonomy over the decisions they make, and another thing is, my guess is that prices would be a lot lower, and therefore real incomes would be a lot higher.
Okay, now I'd like to say something about this. First of all, they need to cut the strings from the federal government. Part of the problem, though, is with socialism that has been infiltrated into this country, it's caused communities to get into all this welfare system. Now, some states can stand alone, others can't. Not very many can. Texas is one of the few that gives more to the federal government than we give back. We'd be better off not taking any federal money and not giving to the federal government and just running our own system. We'd have money left over. Even with the system as it is, the government owes Texas over $6 billion in gold that they still haven't given back to us. But, that's pretty much, gone. Forget it. You're not going to get that back, fellow Texans. But anyway.
Well, answers, gentlemen, it sounds like Congress does have something to do with it because they set the interest rate or they set the tax rates through the budget. And if we can get them on the same page as the counties and the state elected officials to stop this kind of freeloading off of the federal budget that doesn't have to be balanced.
They don't set taxes to
cleaning it up.
You have to get behind the lines here. They don't set the budget according to taxes or vice versa. In fact, this is the problem now is they don't really now cities, municipalities keep two sets of books. Okay? One set of books they show you, and another set of books that they call the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. Okay? And when you look into that, then you'll see, hey, these people are raking in the dough, and they ain't spending
I don't think that there's a whole lot of disagreement on some of the substance here, but, I'm not an apologist for the system, but maybe there's a misunderstanding of what you're trying to describe and what we're getting to. you know, maybe you ought to look into what interest rates are. In fact, I was going to get into this.
I know what interest rates are. They charge a fee, if you will, for loaning money.
It's a discount rate of future goods held against present goods.
Yeah, well,
hang on, guys, one at a time, so we can figure out what somebody's saying. So,
he wanted me to define
something.
But see, this is where we get confused, and your caller from up north there is not really understanding the situation. All right. First of all, you have to understand. No, wait a minute. I'm serious, man. You have to understand Federal Reserve banking, okay? Which is what the Rothschilds are using on us in an extreme perverse. I mean,
I was reading Ludwig von Mises in the year 2000. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to the source, and I'm not caring about what other people's opinions are. And you can laugh all you want, but it's not funny. Okay. Our country got usurped. What's so funny, dude? I mean, what the Rothschild did is insidious.
Somebody sounds angry.
There's no joke about this, all right? Me personally, I don't see anything funny about what the Rothschilds have done to this country and the people that have gotten in bed with them.
Do you eat lunch or dinner or breakfast or anything like that?
I eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner when I get a chance.
Okay.
I work hard for a living.
I'm going to have to go to a break right now, and hope the gentleman will hang out here. I thank you for coming on and listening in and contributing what you're contributing. But I do have to take a small break, about 5 minutes, and we'll be back after that. Everybody who's listening, thanks for listening to Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes with Jason Smith, candidate for Clark County Commission District F, and it's a free-for-all tonight. You guys are welcome to stay on. Mark Anderson and Larry, thanks for hanging in there. We'll be right back.
Approaching just like storm clouds down the line, but it started raining early and you're running out of time, and the devil's in your basement, he's climbing up the stairs, he's here, there, and everywhere. Well, there's horror in the headlines and it's getting worse each day, so if you want to hear some good news, get yourself to church and pray, because when the devil is your anchor man, chooses what to share. He's here, there, and everywhere. Maybe the road is hidden. Maybe you stop looking too. Maybe you'll find you're not so colorblind. Maybe there's something left to do. As the politicians argue and the soldiers fight the war, you're barely keeping score. 'Cause the devil's in your television stirring up a scare. He's here, there, and everywhere. And your government is planning out your funeral today, and you're happy to lay down and let them send you on your way. 'Cause the devil's in your mirror, he's working on his stare. He's here, there, and everywhere. Well, they take away our rights, easy as turning off the lights, and then they tell us that there's nothing we can do. But I'm gonna tell my son the great dark battle can be won when he says, Daddy, will you tell me something true? Are dissolving like imaginary lies. You'll be dancing in the death camps while the trains are keeping time. 'Cause the devil's in the White House in a big fat comfy chair. He's here, there, and everywhere. And oil, drugs, and warfare are the players in this game. And devil when you're running out of air. He's here, there, and everywhere. Here, there, and everywhere.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative. Weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Did you know most Americans know nothing or very little about the legal system? I am the Rose, Rose Colombo, longtime legal activist, legal coach, legal advocate, and the author of Fight Back Legal Abuse, Irwin Award winner, and also my latest political satire, Obamacare Dinosaurs, Rednecks, and Radicals, a political satire exposing the evil agendas of Obamacare and redistribution of wealth that leaves you with a thought-provoking ending. Will mankind survive, or will the U.S. natural-born citizen become extinct? It's available at Amazon.com. You can also visit my website at www.fightbacklegalabuse.com for more information. So order your copy today and empower yourself with knowledge before injustices come knocking on your back door unexpectedly.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Hi, everybody. You're back with Cindy Lake, Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. It's May 20th, Tuesday, and we have Jason Smith, candidate for Clark County Commission District F, joining us. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me in here.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here. Well, today's a big day for candidates who have a primary.
Absolutely. I've been watching eagerly, and also with that in mind, there is an event at the Bellagio. If you've ever wanted to come meet some of these candidates for Clark County office, as well as the judges in Clark County and Nevada, at the Bellagio at Hyde is going to be The Political Party. It is a nonpartisan mix-and-mingle event where you can come and ask questions and hear different speakers and different candidates. The website is politicalpartylv.com. And all the information is there. It's this Thursday from 6 o'clock until whenever the last politician gets tired of speaking. So it could be quite a while.
Uh-huh. Tired of speaking and or drinking.
And or drinking.
The champagne starts to flow at 6 p.m.
That's right. There is a champagne bar that is complimentary for the first hour. And that should loosen everybody up and get the politics talking.
Yeah, sounds like fun. And also we forgot to mention, too, the two sheriff candidates have joined right now, as of right now, that
right.
We know of, and those would be?
Ted Moody is the first one, so he will be there, as well as, I have to remember who it was.
We're not sure about the other one. I'm going to check into Political Party LV and find out. But if you're listening right now, please join us at Hyde Bellagio Thursday the 22nd, 6 p.m., complimentary champagne from 6 till 7, And after that?
Candidates will speak, I think it's about 45 minutes for introductions, and you can hear who all the candidates are. And I'm not sure if we've posted yet the list of all the candidates. I know that we did sell out all of the spots for candidates, so it'll be a full house, plenty of room for, you know, free to come and see all of these guys all dressed up for you.
Well, this should be fun. It should be a really nice event, and I do give credit to those who are organizing the event for doing so.
Being organized by three different political parties, there's members of the Republican Party as well as the Libertarian Party and the Democratic Party that are on the host committee. And this is going to be an ongoing type event. Meet the candidates is the first three. And then after that, every month, we're going to have different speakers. So when Freedom Fest is in town, we're going to do something with them. And hopefully we can get Stossel and some of the other big names down there. And, you know, make it something that everybody can come down and be a part of community politics and business leaders and just from all over Clark County and Nevada.
It's a great idea. You know, we were talking last night about pre-internet phone days, founders days, founding of this country days, and how did people get their information? What did they do?
It starts with just newsletters and newspapers and, you know, magazines. I remember, well, I wasn't alive back then.
Well, maybe in some form you were,
but
really, we
can't. Yeah, sure.
Let's not go there.
But I'm reading about during the 50s and the 60s how there were so many more magazines and newsletters and publications for everything from classic liberal thought all the way up to what is now called neoconservative, and then on the other end of the spectrum, the liberal progressive side. And that's how thoughts and ideas were put out there, and people discussed it through the editorial section of newspapers. We have the internet. We have blogs and radio programs now, which make it a whole lot easier. But it started where we all just had the written word and we sat down and talked about it in our communities.
Well, that's it. That's what I was getting to, is sitting down in person in the community in Town Square or at the Green Dragon,
right,
is where they would go to, you know, discuss these ideas. And they didn't have access to the things that we do and even though we have access to all these ways to get our information, it's crowded. The field is really crowded as the corners where every sign for a political candidate is up now. It's very crowded, and I feel like I'm very plugged in to the political arena, and I'm still somewhat confused with, who do I vote for in this? I didn't meet all the judges, honestly. I haven't met all the judges. I haven't met all the candidates, and there are so many this year that it's really important to get out to these events and meet these people in person. I've developed rapport with people whom I never thought I would before. So we're telling you who are listening to please tell your friends and family and neighbors about the event Thursday at Bellagio. You don't have to get dressed up to come.
No, you guys.
You don't have to worry about what you're wearing, but we do want you there, and we do want you to ask questions of the candidates. An informed voter is what the community benefits from. We don't benefit from an uninformed voter.
That's right. And
we suffer.
We've partnered with Green Fund, the PDF group, as well as CBS now is I think we're in talks right now to have them come out, cover the event, give us possibly some candidates that can do interviews afterward, and ask some serious questions. Maybe take a bunch of questions from the audience and then have some of these political reporters from these media outlets ask some real questions that we want answers to from not just to me, but from me. I'd like to ask a couple of judges what your thoughts are on jury nullification. And if you run away from that question, I want to know that you don't have the temerity to stand up for, you know, what America was founded on, the Sixth Amendment, our right to a jury trial by our peers instead of some magistrate that, you know, dictates from on high. We should know what kind of judges are running and be able to ask those questions. And personal communication, I think, it's harder to BS somebody when you're looking at them in the eyes. When they can write something on a website and that's what you're supposed to go off of, who knows if they even wrote it. But when you can have somebody stand in front of you and answer those questions, you kind of know if they buy what they're selling.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't tell you how much more I've learned about a candidate from meeting them personally than, like you said, how do you know who wrote that? They may have a beautiful website that they've never had a hand in. They've never written. Their bio might be totally fabricated.
Right.
They might not even have a clue about the issues that they're running on, and vice versa. They may even be well-versed in something that they didn't mention on their website, or they may not even have a website because they're a grassroots candidate. We can only know that if we meet them in person. And so, anyway, this is really important, folks. May 22nd, Thursday, Hyde Bellagio, 6 to 9 p.m. If you're a candidate, you can attend as well and be present and be able to have your constituents ask you questions.
And it's www.politicalpartylv for Las Vegas, so politicalpartylv.com. And you go to the event, you can click onto it, and it tells you all the information, times, directions if you need it, and go ahead and RSVP just to make sure that it kind of makes things quicker at the door.
Okay, we have a question from somebody who's on the freedomizertheradio.com website. It just happens to be a really special somebody, Roxanne, who's one of my best volunteers, and she smiles and dials hundreds of times per day, calling targeted voters to get out the vote for Cindy Lake, and lets me know if anybody has a question so I can call them back. And she's an awesome volunteer. She's here. Her husband helps with signs. She wants to know positions, our positions, Jason, on food, guns, taxes, marijuana, and small business. You go first.
Well, I'll answer the 600-pound elephant question in the room, or 6,000-pound, as it were, with marijuana. I'm a libertarian. I am not shy about that. I am 39 years old, which means that I am legally an adult. As an adult, I like to think that I can make the best choices with my body with regard to food and drugs or alcohol for myself. I don't need somebody that, frankly, may not be smarter than me telling me because they got elected to a position that cannabis is not going to cure me if I have cancer, when it's not they that are dying, it is me that would be, you know, fighting cancer.
God forbid.
Yeah.
I have to add that. God forbid, not good. And
absolutely. As far as food, I think we should have an educated populace. I think that it is up to the consumer to know what they're eating. And if you have labels on certain things, it makes it easier. But I don't support a government telling a food company they have to package something a certain way. But as a consumer, I'm not buying a package of something unless I'm confident that it's not going to harm me. As far as guns, that's the Second Amendment. I don't think there's anything in the Second Amendment that overshadows the phrase shall not be infringed. I think that's pretty clear. Regarding small businesses, that's what this country was built on. I mean, going all the way back to the very beginning, and I'm not talking about the beginning of the colonies. I'm talking about the United States of America, 13 different colonies that came together and expanded from that point. It was built on people making alcohol and bringing it to the western frontier to give to fur trappers and different tradesmen. It was built on somebody building wagon wheels and, you know, selling those. It was not built on somebody from England that wanted to own all the tea that was in America. Just to tick them off, you know, we drink more coffee than tea, so how's that? So I think small businesses is the backbone of the country. What I unfortunately see happening is the corporations out there now that have gotten so large are writing their own regulations, and those regulations that are passed by Congress, because lobbyists from these corporations have such access, they make it impossible for a small, not impossible, they make it very, very difficult for a small business to get off the ground to compete. And if there's no competition, you have a large corporation doing whatever they want, giving you substandard products at overpriced prices. So the consumer loses, and I'm for the consumer.
Ditto. I love following Jason. And, you know, an interesting fact, little tidbit, is that Jason doesn't have a primary. Lucky Jason. Jason's a registered libertarian, and Cindy Lake is a registered Republican. And yet we agree on so many things.
Funny, huh?
It's kind of weird how we agree on so many things, you know, and the average voter out there doesn't realize that I think the parties were set up to have a fight with each other and disagree with each other and argue with each other. And the primary system in and of itself, that's another thing I want to talk about, is how that disenfranchises a Jason Smith, a most informed voter, who I would love to have the opportunity to vote for me and people like me, but he cannot vote for me and people like me in the primary. He's disenfranchised because he's not registered one of two major parties from voting in the primary, and I think that's so wrong, and I think we need to do something about that real quick. That's another part of my platform position that I've been talking about. It grows every day, it seems. My platform is growing every day. But on the things that you just asked about, Roxanne, I feel the same way as Jason does, and I'll take it just one little tiny further step. I'm going to introduce an ordinance for a moratorium on small business, at least county business licensees, for 3 years, and those new businesses who are in business less than 5 years who are struggling, and we'll figure out a criteria for that. But I want to encourage small business growth. And on the converse side, I don't want to discourage small business growth. Like Jason was saying, large corporations being holding hands with the government and all the incentives that they're given to do business are discouraging small business growth and fees and taxes, Obamacare and license fees and all that stuff. So my goal when I'm elected is to sort through all these things that are preventing small businesses from even getting off the ground. And Jason is a small business owner, I'm a small business owner, so we know what a person, an individual would have to go through in order to just open the doors before you ever get started. It's literally thousands of dollars in fees and licensing things that you have to go through before you even open your doors and you're open for business. And that is definitely prohibitive to a small business who will ultimately be a job creator and producer.
Well, it can get pretty nefarious when you're talking about government and business in the same breath. It wasn't too long ago that our esteemed Harry Reid made a little agreement with Anderson Dairy here to keep them from having to compete with all those pesky little dairy farmers out of California. So what he's done is, sure, he's protected Nevada's dairy, Anderson Dairy, at the expense of the consumers here that live in southern Nevada. We no longer have the choice to buy a less expensive product from a different state because maybe the dairy in our state is not running efficiently enough. You take on top of that, I don't know if anybody's tried to open a dairy farm, good luck with the licensing on that, good luck with the permits, good luck with getting your subsidy for any milk product the federal government gives without being in lockstep hand-in-hand with Harry Reid. On top of that, try getting a license to bring into the state of Nevada raw milk. The dairy farmers and the ones that really own most of the dairy business in this country don't want to sell raw milk. They have a pasteurization product or a pasteurization plan, in effect, that gives them longer shelf life, less nutritious dairy products, and maybe they can add something to it, but it's still not fresh raw milk. Isn't that something the consumer should make a choice on? Maybe understand the dangers of an expired raw milk. It might be more dangerous than an expired pasteurized milk, but who's drinking expired milk? I mean, this is not the question. The question is, should we have access to it?
Actually, I can add there that raw milk never really goes bad for you. It was actually used to preserve food in the old days. And, yeah, it does turn into something else, buttermilk and all that other stuff, sour cream you can make from it. But pasteurized milk, when it goes bad, will kill you.
Absolutely.
So
You're speaking my language when it comes to raw milk. I want my raw milk, and it's funny that you mentioned Dirty Harry, because he does control the dairy industry and so many other things in this state, and we have a raw milk bill sailed through the legislature last session. Both Democrats and Republicans voted to allow raw milk, and that got vetoed by Harry's right-hand man, Sandoval, who's also up for election and is technically a registered Republican, but the lines are so blurred with voter registration, the letter after your name. I still say it causes more problems than what it's worth. There should be no identifying letter after your name on any ballot. Every single race should be considered nonpartisan, and every single registered voter should be allowed to vote for whom the candidate they want to vote for. So we have to do something about that too, Jason. Funded elections are funded with taxpayer dollars. You're a taxpayer. Well, primaries, yes, they are funded with taxpayer dollars. You're a taxpayer. Some of your tax dollars are going to pay for the primaries that you're not allowed to vote in.
That's right.
How maddening is that? That is such a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
We didn't touch and then the Republic trash thing. Thanks, Mike. Another pet peeve. Here we go. My platform is growing and growing and growing. We have a few more minutes to talk about that. Have you looked at your opponent's contributions and expenses?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Okay, did you happen to notice Republic?
I happen to notice a lot of different utilities, which in my opinion, are government-protected monopolies. And yes, I think each and every one of them donated to the incumbent, as well as cab companies, as well as casinos. I didn't see a whole lot comparatively with the small businesses. I saw a lot of large companies with lots of little aspects to them, and they all donated on the same day. So obviously somebody there has control of lots of little subsidiaries, and they each got to donate. I'm asking for $10, $20, and $30 at a time, and, you know, $10,000 from this utility, $10,000 from this, and then each one of a casino group. You get $10,000 from each of them if you can get the boss at the top to give. So it does make it difficult to run against an incumbent. I do have to have faith that there's a way to beat it, and I think the message is how you do it. I know a lot of people out there say the message isn't as important as getting your party in office, but what has a party person done in office really for us? I'd like to let everybody out there know, go ahead and Google Sandy Shores, Georgia, and see how that city has run themselves over the last eight years since they broke off from Fulton. What they've done is, I think they have six employees that are non-police and fire. And everybody gets a contract if you want to provide services, road services, trash services, stuff like that. You get a one-year contract. If you stink at your job, we don't have to go through the union to get rid of you. You just won't get that contract when it comes up again. We'll have other people compete for it. And that way there's no PERS here in Nevada. You have a pension system that is 70% funded. Well, 70% funded is 30% short. I don't care how you do the math, if it's Common Core or old time in the calculator or pen and paper, it's not fully funded. And unfunded liabilities tend to get out of hand. And what they've figured out is, and it's not as big as Clark County, obviously, but it is a start. It's an idea to get out there instead of giving a whole slew of employees their pension. What you do is you set up a 401k that they can go to another company if they no longer work in this business. And instead of managing now a pension fund as well as a 401k, and like if you're like most of us out there, we know we have to save on our own because Social Security is not going to be there for us. You have to have another savings fund. It's way too convoluted, too many opportunities for waste, fraud, and abuse. What we need to get to is the old-fashioned being responsible for yourself and communities being responsible for the members of their community by going through things like charity. I was asked by News 8 for a candidate summary. There were a dozen questions. One of them was,
what's something you would like people to know about me? I took the opportunity to say, if you want to know something about me, give me a call, shoot me an email. What I want you to do is look in your local neighborhoods. What charities that are working hard to raise money and take care of kids? Opportunity Village, the Assistance League. There are charities out there that are working their tails off that are not government funded. They have a plan. They have their own people working and donating time and being volunteers. Go give $10. Go give an hour a week to them. And that's my message to the people. Let's start relying on ourselves and not the government to handle things for us.
I'm not trying to cut you short, but we do have another just 2 minutes, and that you're awesome. You're absolutely right. Jason Smith for Clark County Commission District F. I wanted to mention that Jason was endorsed by Veterans in Politics International, as was I, and I'm really proud of that endorsement.
Absolutely.
And I'm proud of the endorsements we're not getting as well. so take that for what it is. Jason, do you have a website?
Yes. The website is not active yet. I'm still tweaking it and
okay.
trying to get it up and running. But
okay, we'll let you know about Jason's website, cindylake.net. If you want to know about Cindy Lake at all, cindylake.net. We will be at Bellagio Thursday, 6 to 9 p.m. So all the sheriff candidates, several of them, including Ted Moody, who was also endorsed by Veterans in Politics. There are a lot of good events coming up for you to meet the candidates. Thank you for listening and joining with us tonight. Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake. We'll see you back here next Tuesday. I'm going to try to live stream next Tuesday so that you can see us and be with us, and we're going to put that on YouTube. We're getting technical here, folks. Thank you again for being with us tonight. We'll see you next Tuesday. Vote Cindy Lake for Clark County District G, Jason Smith for Clark County District F. Thanks and have a great evening.
Did you know most Americans know nothing or very little about the legal system?